about your story until it was either right before Jorge Ventura came in here, or I think it might have literally been when we were on air.
That day.
Yeah. He was telling me about this. I think we recorded like the end of July.
Okay.
And what an oversight, because holy, you've been in the middle of this for a long time, my man.
Yeah, it's been a long run, and I actually heard about you for the first time from Jorge as well.
Love that.
And, dude, you've been blowing it up, doing great stuff. I'm glad to see this podcast doing what you're doing. You're wired so right. And it's an honor to be on the show, for one, but we got to give a big shout-out to our brother Jorge.
Absolutely.
He and I have done some fantastic work together, and Sognik, who kind of brought all the production behind the scenes. And you heard a couple stories in his episode of the madness we ran into in Siskiyou County, and I've probably got a few more we'll talk about today potentially, but – thanks to our brother. He's doing good stuff out there as well.
Absolutely. He's really impressive. I mean, there's some people who like to put their fingernails in the dirt, and that makes them really great at their job. And there's no doubt he's got that gene. Like, you know, it actually kind of reminded me, like, once I knew your story, his story's very similar. Like, bump when he went to make the first documentary that you were involved with, where he, like, bumps into this scene of, like, giant cartel plantations run by Chinese in California. He's like, what
crazy.
The fuck? Yeah. And you – working at, it used to be called the California Game and...
We used to be the California Department of Fish and Game, and then we changed to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Got it.
And we're still game wardens, though. I, you know, promote that because game implies hunting, and hunting is good for conservation, as you know, being a conservationist. You're part of that thin green line, Julian, and we're all part of that team, which is fantastic. And, I was there almost 30 years, about just over 28. Mind-blowing career.
Yeah.
You know, it was a dream. It felt like it was about a 10-year career. Growing up hunting, fishing, learning to, you know, just be in the outdoors and savor everything the blessings are out there to offer.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up right in the Silicon Valley Bay Area, like right inland from Santa Cruz in the San Jose Bay Area, but down in the southern county of Santa Clara County, where you have cattle ranches, big parks, open spaces. So, and people don't realize the Silicon Valley has a lot of wildlife resources around it and just some beautiful open spaces, both private and public. And I'm still down there, you know, 30-40% of the time now in Montana full time.
Oh, you're a Montana guy.
Yeah.
I hear amazing things about Montana.
It's, you know, man, Montana is one of the last of the best left wilderness states in the lower 48 for sure. And a short story, my grandfather was career Navy, deployed in Pearl Harbor. His cruiser got sunk. He survived amazingly and had a 20-year naval career. But right before he went into the Navy and was deployed before that fateful day, you know, in Pearl Harbor, he took some high school buddies up to Libby, Montana, found it out of nowhere. They took a road trip, and it was like the Narnia of animals. They had bear and they had white-tailed deer. Mm-hmm. They harvested a bunch of stuff. And he said, hey, if I make it out of my naval career, all my kids, we're going to settle a place up here, buy some property. And there's nine kids in my dad's family, right? And everyone's going to get an acre they can keep or not or live on or whatever. And I'm one of the next generation that have settled there. Dad's now gone. He actually passed, ironically, in 2013, which was the year I got to start the pilot program and form up the marijuana enforcement team, the spec ops unit, a career dream that was 13, 14 years in the making. So we're having the death of my mentor and my hero, my dad, you know, fighting cancer right as we're about to go operational and start this unit. And of course, he was a huge supporter of that and super proud. If it wasn't for that conservation mindset and ethos handed down through the generations, I wouldn't be here. You know?
So you grew up though, like you were saying, like out in the wilderness in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In tune with nature. Were you thinking about being like a military guy or did you always kind of want to go towards domestic and working in that space?
It was a serendipitous thing the way it worked out to be a game warden, because ironically, all the times I spent out there, and I mean, I got my hunter education license at 9 years old with my dad's help.
Wow.
And I'm hunting ducks for the first time, waterfowl on these cold mornings over in the Los Banos Central Valley area, shooting my first ducks, bringing them home to eat.
Shooting ducks?
Yep.
Well, I love ducks.
Ducks are fantastic, you know.
I love them though.
Yeah, I do too.
You like shooting them?
To harvest for food? Absolutely. As long as you know, and you know what I'm going to say, because see what everyone maybe doesn't know, you are a conservationist, man. I just learned this before starting the show, so another big kudo. But yeah, we've been hunting and fishing our whole lives. Ironically, though, of all that time in the outdoors with my dad or alone hunting, I never ran into a game warden. I didn't even know game wardens existed.
Yeah, that's still a fascinating thing to me.
Yeah. So I never ran into one. So I was never checked by this amazing career officer, you know, that does like what I think is the dream, you know, law enforcement job. And then I'm going to college with an engineering scholarship, looking into the ROTC to go into Special Forces Army because we had that at San Jose State. San Jose State's a real good engineering and, ironically, a good criminal justice school. I'm in it for engineering. In the first year, I'm doing all the schooling and, you know, looking at the military option to do the GI Bill and do SF as an officer. And I meet a game warden on a winter hike in between semesters with my longtime Baja racing buddy and motorcycle guy. And, you know, we're in the backcountry in the middle of a stormy December week. No one's in this park. And a game warden checks us out of the blue after a long storm one night. And
what do you mean he checks you?
He's patrols in. We got a camp. We've been hiking all the night before, pouring rain. We're soaking wet. We got a pack horse carrying our stuff. And here we are 13 miles into the backcountry, and we hear this truck, you know, four-wheel drive coming down this mountain above us. I'm like, ooh, who's that? Figured it was a park ranger because it's a state park we're in. Look up, and it's a green truck, and the parks guys have green trucks. And I'm thinking, oh, he's going to check us. And I realized, oh, man, we had a fire last night. I don't think fires are allowed in the park, but we had to have one. We were hypothermic and dumb college kids to dry our out. You know, the horse is fine, but all of our stuff is soaking freaking wet.
Don't mind the beer pong table.
Yeah, we don't have that. And just that's smoke from another thing. It's not a fire. And he goes, no, I'm not a park ranger, guys. I'm a game warden. I'm like, what's that? And so I bent his ear for like 2 long hours. And he thought we were poaching black-tailed deer, which are a mule deer in California. And that's when the prime rut's going on, and these are monster bucks, trophy bucks back in that area, and there's a lot of poaching going on, which I wasn't aware of at the time. And so he's looking at anybody in the park when people wouldn't normally be backpacking in storms around Christmas, and he's looking for guys poaching wildlife. Realizes we're dumb college kids just backpacking, and he wants to get out of there. I'm like, wait a minute. And that was it. After that conversation, he left, and my buddy Jeff looked at me and he goes, dude, your eyes are as big as silver dollars. You're like wired. What's up? And I go, I'm doing the wrong job.
That's what I want to do.
Mm. And Julian, for it to be so far in the backcountry where we never saw another soul in 105,000 square acres, we saw one game warden. We got out of there. I go,
divine.
I'm done. It was divine. Yeah. It was absolutely intervention. And you know, when you two good paths and a path you weren't even aware of, and boom, now I've got this. So I race back to college on the winter break, go to the criminal justice advisor, a maniac professor named Mike Rustigan. They called him Professor Murder. He was like a serial murder expert and just amazing.
Oh, I thought you were going to say he was murder.
No. Professor of, thankfully. Otherwise, I was looking at the wrong guy.
It's like, damn.
But man, he goes, hey, John, you can change your major right now. We place FBI, ATF. We got a nationally known criminal justice school. And I was off to the races and didn't miss a lick. And then for about 4 years later, I was in the academy, the Police Fish and Game Academy up in Napa College.
Oh, that's a separate academy.
Yep.
Okay.
We have our own academy. It's a full police academy, and then 7 more weeks of stuff on top of it that's just wildlife specific. Wildlife ID, doing forensics, you know, if you're looking at poaching cases versus like people cases, tactics on how to hide, how to stalk, how to, you know, get into the backcountry and not get burned by bad guys doing bad things as far as wildlife crimes go. And you get to learn all that in addition to all the police stuff that we would learn in California under standards.
Yeah, it also seems like way harder because in addition to the police stuff you just mentioned right there, you guys basically have to be nature experts and environmental experts. And in some way, like this is a science. You got to know like, oh, that type of deer is always going to be in this type of area. And here's why. And here's how to track that. Like this is the kind of stuff that in the old world would be passed down across generations that people spent their whole lives growing up among. But you're just being – not that you didn't spend time in the wilderness, but you're kind of being like thrown into it. Like, okay, go get them, tiger.
Exactly. That's the best way to say it. And you have to have that knowledge because unlike a city policeman – with backup a minute away in the city streets or, you know, some movement is very easy and very fast. We get behind lock gates far into the backcountry where backup's 3 to 5 hours away, if they can even find you. And we work alone 9 times out of 10. And maybe we have a canine with us. Hopefully we have a partner, but we're so spread out and responsible for such large geographical regions as game wardens. You have to be able to work alone. You have to be able to self-start, self-motivate. Mm. You don't go to a substation. You have one vehicle assigned to you for its life. It stays at home with you. You have a state phone. You work out of your office home. So you're basically responsive. You can get out and get in the field if somebody calls you with a problem, like a rancher that has a mountain lion that just killed a bunch of his sheep. And now this lion is maybe in a city area and injured. And now it's a public safety problem. And you got this big cat and you got to deal with it and be able to respond quickly. So it's a really unique individual self-motivated job. But it's in the outdoors 90%, man. And, you know, the saying in my family's always been the woods are my church. And there's a lot of, you know, just spiritual strengthening and breathing fresh air and getting out of the riffraff and, you know, everything from people being depressed or, you know, lacking direction. Some places you get them in the outdoors, some of these kids we work with, and it is inspiring, Julian.
Oh,
let me tell you. Really inspiring to see what effect that has and the strength that it creates within. And that's where I found my niche. It's where I belonged.
I just had a guy in here, Orlat and Lobo, with the entire crew that was doing the Rhino Man documentary. His partner, he's a real ranger.
Okay.
His partner, I think that was episode 232, but his partner was the guy who was the Anton Nzimba, who was murdered by the poaching rings over there, like hunted down at his house in front of his family. He tried to kill his family too. Oof. I mean, it is crazy.
Yeah.
How bad it is and how, you know, cause it's all this, it's all money. It's all funded from East Asia in that case. But you're running into, I believe, if I remember correctly, maybe Jorge told me this. I don't think you and I talked about this, but you're running into like the ivory trade and stuff comes back to California illegally, right?
Yeah.
What happens there?
Yeah. You get, so you said it best. It's all money and that's why guys are killing each other for it over in Africa, right? Wildlife trafficking for money is second or sometimes tied, depending on what year you're looking at, with the narcotics trade worldwide.
We're talking. I didn't know that.
Oh, no, yeah. Wildlife parts, ivory, gallbladders from black bear, sturgeon roe, the actual eggs from a sturgeon body that are a delicacy in overseas markets. So we'll get poachers, you know, poaching sturgeon, these big, massive prehistoric fish, you know, in our rivers in California. We'll get black bears being killed just to take their gallbladder because it's worth up to $40,000 or more on the black market when it's dried, crunched into a powder, and it's an aphrodisiac for Asian clients overseas. So these guys will fight to the death for this stuff, and it's so similar to the fight we've had in California, not only for dealing with this international wildlife that comes in illegally for sales, and our department deals with that. We have a wildlife trafficking team that's specifically mandated to work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the federal and state level combined, intercepting this stuff at airports, dealing with covert deals of this getting sold once it makes it over to the U.S. And what people will pay for wildlife parts, whether they're illegally mounted animals or, like I said, the ivory, the gallbladders, it's freaking mind-blowing.
Guys, it's that time of year again. You're making those New Year's resolutions. Now, obviously, a lot of these things we usually give up on by February, if not earlier. It's just the nature of what it is as human beings. And I know I've struggled with that in the past myself. But today we're going to talk about a product that will do things for you automatically so that you don't have to think about it. And you can't maybe give in to those urges to give up the good new habits. And that's why today's episode is sponsored by our friends over at Acorns. You've heard me talk about these guys before. Acorns is a unique investment platform that allows you to invest either your spare change or whatever predetermined amount you want every single day. You set it and it's going to do it for you automatically. I've told the story before, but I started using Acorns back in March 2020 at the very beginning of the pandemic. And over time, my money was given the opportunity to grow and I was able to invest into some things, including some of the very equipment in the studio here today, which is pretty cool when you think about it. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing so that your money has a chance to grow for you, your kids, and your retirement. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that fits you and your money goals. And like I was just saying with my own story a few seconds ago, you don't have to be rich either. You can start with $5 or even just your spare change. Also, it's so easy to set up an account. I did it inside of 5 minutes and you can too. So head on over to acorns.com/Julian. That link is in the description below. Or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today.
This is a paid client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 1 compensation provided. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors LLC and SEC registered investment advisor. Few important disclosures at acorns.com/Julian.
And there's a lot of resources that go into it, and some very, very wealthy, affluent people with resources dive into this stuff.
That's crazy.
And it does exactly what you're saying. It's not hunting and fishing that wipes out wildlife species. That's all managed to benefit wildlife species.
Yes.
It's the greedy, you know, I got to have that, you know, that aphrodisiac, right, to have rhino horn or whatever. And now you're losing an ivory animal that, you know, may never come back. So
yeah, they're basically like our dinosaurs that
are
still here.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. And that's why when I see some of these pictures of people who go to game sites in Africa and legally shoot some of these sometimes, I'm like, what? Anything else? Like go shoot caribou. Go do something.
Yeah.
But like don't shoot a fucking elephant, man.
Yeah.
It's something about that offends my
Yeah, you know, it's a mixed bag because people ask me, because I've been to Africa twice now, and I've hunted in South Africa twice. I have a very good outfitter friend, going to go back, going to do more work in Kruger National Park with their rangers where there's no hunting. You just see them. Yep. Elephants are thriving, you know, rhinos, lions. And I say it this way, if it's managed properly, and right now in Africa, a guy that wants to go hunt a lion, right, that's at the end of his life and he's going to pay big money to do it, he's going to do good for the lion population because that money's going to go back into balancing the lion population, making sure they're protected. Not my cup of tea. I don't want to go shoot a lion. I kind of have a fondness for the big cat.
I understand what you're saying.
Or like an elephant. You know, I would not shoot an elephant myself. But if some guy's going to do it legally or some gal's going to do it legally and ethically, there is a place for it. It's not going to hurt that animal overall. Is if it's done legally, because that's where that conservation model kicks in, but it's not for everybody. And it's same thing with fishing, right? Catch and release. Some guys just want to fly fish and they want to catch that beautiful trout and let it go. And that's fantastic, you know, and other people want to eat the fish that have really good protein. They're really tasty. They're overpopulated in certain lakes and they have a certain number that are allowed or not allowed based on science studies and biology studies we do. So say, yeah, you can take 3 cutthroat trout, you know, from this river, or you can take 3 rainbow from the Kootenai River in Montana, where I'm from, or one of the high lakes, you can take cutthroat, but don't take more than 3 or you'll be in trouble because they can only sustain so much take in their breeding cycle and, you know, the next generations to keep those fish in there. So it's a delicate balance. And I look at it this way. If it's not for me, I'm not going to take that animal. But if someone's going to do it legally, I'm going to accept it because I know it's going to help that animal, but I may not like it. It's a fine line, especially with the African animals.
Yeah. But it's also like hard because, again, you're responsible for patrolling basically like thousands and thousands of miles of wilderness.
Yeah.
And people are out there. You're not going to be on top of them. And it's like an honor system. Like, I'm just making up an animal right now. But, I caught 3 of this type of bass today.
Right.
That's the max of what I'm allowed to do. No one will ever know if I do 4.
Yeah.
But then
– or there's 5 hiding in that bush.
You got to try to – then you got to come out there sniffing like, he caught 4. And you got to arrest him or something.
Yeah.
But it's like a very weird – it's not like – you know, you walk into a bank and rob it. Okay, all right, let's get the cops in here. It's in the middle of the city.
It's not black and white over crime, punishment, good, bad, good guys, or whatever the stereotype is. It is. It's a different type of law enforcement, which makes it interesting for one. And it also makes it, I think, sometimes under-respected, you know, because people say, okay, you guys are game wardens, you're fish cops. So a guy took too many fish, a couple. What crime against humanity is that? You know, where you got a drug deal going on down here with this guy's going to die from it, or there's progress. And what people need to realize is at the end of the day, we are all law enforcement officers. Public safety is our priority. Wildlife enforcement is our mandate. It's our forte. So we're all force multipliers, you know, and game wardens now throughout the nation, fortunately, and the world really are getting the respect and I think the awareness largely because of podcasts like this.
Yeah.
You know, when Joe Rogan and I talked about what game wardens do, and we dove into the thin green line, and well, the cannabis thing just blew his mind. And, you know, being a cannabis guy, and he hunts elk and he's a conservationist and, you know, has become a friend through this process of going, holy crap, man, game wardens are doing a lot more. I mean, I was thinking you were just checking fishing licenses, you know, and like, oh, you don't have your hunting license. It's a stamp on a write you an administrative ticket and you're getting gunfights with cartels and your dogs are being attacked and these guys are in the mind blowing. That's what game wardens do. And we have more likelihood to encounter a gunfight without support than most cops do just because of where we're at and what we're doing. But the caveat, the silver lining in all this is 95%+ of everybody we run into that has a gun is a friendly. Mm. You know, they're allies. They're you and me in the woods hunting, and here comes the game warden. It's like, oh, hey, cool. He's going to check us, and I saw this guy doing this. Now I know who to call. Now I've got a contact of my local warden who's 20 minutes away, not 20 hours away.
Right.
I'm not going into a phone tree and calling a 1-800 turn in a poacher line where I might get a call back 2 days later, and I'm on the Feather River in California and just saw a massive sturgeon poaching operation going from like Russian mobsters wanting that sturgeon roe, knowing these fish were going to go out and make hundreds of thousands, if not more, money on the black market. And the fish is probably going to be wasted. And
the Russian mobsters are out there with a line catching
the
fish.
They may not be catching them, but yeah, some of them do.
Fish coming boat right now. I need to see that.
The $10,000 fish, it's a small one. $100,000 fish, it's a big one. Look the other way. Make sure.
throwing knives in the water, like, get in boat.
Make sure that guy doesn't come to me. Yeah. So it's an amazing career, but it has its challenges, and every day it keeps changing. I mean, when I started in 92 and I'm in the academy as a 21-year-old wet behind the ears pup out of college, did 11 months in juvenile probation working with, like, you know, the murderers and the gangsters in juvenile hall, some really nasty, some good kids just in a wrong mix. Had a great time having that experience before going into Fish and Wildlife to see that perspective, because I would run into later on these Mexican cartels.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't think I would ever be jumping out of Black Hawk helicopters and running a tactical unit with some of the best canines on the planet, chasing down guys that want to hurt us or kill us or anybody that comes across their multi-million dollar crop in the Silicon Valley foothills where I grew up, and not knowing that at that point it would span to not only a statewide problem, but we would see this embedded throughout America. And I would be sitting here with you telling this story that's morphed into a massive problem beyond wildlife. You know?
Yeah, it's kind of like if you've ever seen in the movies or regular in documentaries with fucking Google Earth now, when people zoom in on something and then it like suddenly shows you the scene and the problem.
Yeah.
But you zoom back out and you could zoom in on somewhere else and you could see the same kind of thing happening, or like a parallel thing happening. When you look around the country, especially on states that are close to the border, or specifically all along the, what is it, 2,000-mile border or something along Mexico, U.S., like the shit that's going on that somehow like doesn't get reported to this day is crazy. And you say it yourself, like you've been in the middle of this for at this point like decades, essentially. So you've seen this long before this was, you know, we're going to build a wall, Mexico is going to pay for it. Like you were there way before that.
Yeah.
And yet that seems to only – I guess it was like 2015 when he started saying that. That was kind of in my life the first time where I remember it even really being talked about.
Right.
How crazy this had gotten to. Like, does it ever feel like to you, like throughout your career, has it ever felt like the fix is in? Meaning, like people, they don't want to cover this because there's some I don't know, darker forces at play.
I think that's possible. I don't doubt it. I also think we have a point of just sensory overload on the problem when we talk about the depth of it. Mm. And in general, people want to shut down because it's a dark, dark picture.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it wasn't until, like you said, when that wall idea came up, all of us would do anything. And border agents that I work with on the southern border now that I've taught, trained with, or, you know, been down there on doing documentaries myself with our Thin Green Line film team, you know, we saw this before the wall was even an issue. And when the wall was going up before the last administration switched over, how much trafficking was going on. And, you know, I liken it to cartels and weed, which we can dive into in more detail of why that's such a problem. But people think, okay, so these game wardens formed a team and there's these, you know, special operations guys running around the woods trying to take down these cartels. But I don't, you know, weed's not my backyard. I don't use weed.
Right.
I'm not going to consume it. You know, it's legal now, so I can just go to a dispensary and all that's legal and it's pure and it's organic, which we all know is wrong, not happening that way all the time.
Even in the dispensaries.
Even in the dispensaries. Mm. Yeah. Dispensaries have to, like, we'll take California as an example. And this is where being the weed state of the world, because California grows wonderful cannabis, because we're one of only six true Mediterranean climates on the globe. So like Napa Valley wine, we're known for, and wine vineyards, cannabis the same way, indoor, outdoor. And on a dry year, you can grow outdoor with good soil, good nutrients from February to darn near Christmas.
Cali Kush, baby.
Cali Kush, baby. And it's tier one stuff. That whole Emerald Triangle up there, Humboldt, Del Norte, Mendo, you know, all those counties up there. And we have a lot of legitimate growers up there doing it by the numbers. And why does dispensary weed sometimes have this toxically tainted with EPA banned chemicals embedded on the plant in dispensaries? Because the legal market is going under, right? We regulated in 2016 with Prop 64. I know you and Jorge talked a little bit about this. Mm. And our team had been operational now for 3 years. And everyone's saying, well, you guys just created your ninja black operations team, you know, and you're going to be out of a job because this is all going to go away. And we're like, no, it's not. You know, you're going to regulate.
What made you so sure?
I knew right away with taxation, with oversight, and the cost of doing business for these good, legitimate, legal growers that want to do everything by the numbers. And keep in mind, there's a good percentage of growers in Northern California, throughout all of California, and throughout other parts of the nation that were doing it right other than it being illegal, right, on a statute. They were conserving water because they love their outdoors. Most of these are outdoor, rural, mountainous growers, so they want their pristine woods for their church too. So they're out there living in that environment, and they want to use as little water as possible to conserve water on the cannabis they're generating, right? They're never going to put a toxic poison on it. They're going to get rewarded by, it's called DEM, Dragonfly or DEM certification. Like, if you have an organically pure product that doesn't have one pesticide on it, you're going to get this, like, it's like a Michelin rating, right?
Yeah.
In the grower community, you're going to get 3 stars.
Right.
And we know that's really pure cannabis for people that want to get a good product. They're cannabis users. But now we're going to regulate. And we're going to do one thing. You're going to have to go through, I don't know, 7 to 11 permit processes from different agencies. You're going to spend $50,000 to maybe $120,000 on your cannabis operation to get it certified by 5 agencies. You're going to pay a lot of tax on it. You're going to pay a distributor a mad amount of money that there's corruption and you may not get the money you're owed. So right now in Cali, as an example, we have tier one growers that should be doing it and are doing it by the numbers that you want to see there doing what we change for law. And they're shutting down. They're going under because the black market folks run by the cartels are making potent 22 to 27% THC content strains of weed. It's dirty as heck with neurotoxins on it, most of it, but they're going to the black market where people can afford it. It is cheaper than legitimate cannabis and they're making billions, not millions, but billions of cash dollars from that side and running good growers out. And then I also knew we had a year, this is an interesting story, but we had a year of grace period when we regulated in 2016. It was late 2015 and I was getting asked as the lieutenant and the team leader for the marijuana enforcement team to go around the state to these grower meetings that were being called and big public forums and big, you know, 400 or 500 growers coming out and, you know, a cannabis leader from the California Growers Association would panel it. Legislators and growers would speak on what the legislation was going to be. And then they'd have me there. In camo, you know, got a PowerPoint up and they're looking at this first cop that's ever been at a grower meeting. They keep in mind, bro, these are growers that have been black market for 20 years. Cash business. They're coming out of the dark, going like, to like a veterans hall in Santa Cruz, which is where one of them was, ironically, from our old stomps.
Yeah, we get so many Santa Cruz people in here. It's so bizarre. And Alessi's from Santa Cruz.
Yeah. And so Alessi will appreciate this one.
One of them Luis Navia? Oh, so we can sell the cocaine for legal now.
Louis might have been there. No. Louis, no offense. I do not personally remember you there, but if you were, it would have been an honor.
Yeah, that's that guy, like the way he talks about Santa Cruz, very different from everyone else. He's like, oh, yeah, we were out there drinking, smoking, fucking. It was amazing. I'm like... Is this your Santa Cruz, Alessi?
Hey, man, it's Lost Boys legacy,
sounds awesome.
Man. Yeah, Alessi, we were talking about Lost Boys. Anything goes on that boardwalk, baby, in Santa Cruz. But so I go to this first meeting, and the eyes of these girls are like, what's he doing here?
Cop.
He's looking at our license plates. He's probably got a case on us. I'm like, oh, time out. Everybody breathe. Take a minute. This
like
is who I am.
Join on stage.
Yeah. Like, yeah, just pretending, you know, all non-herbal. No. But I take like that big time. I'm going, guys, I'm going to tell a story. We're here to educate. We're not arresting anybody. You're about to go into legal regulation. You're going to have to register, but I want to show you what we're fighting that you're part of the fight for. And the PowerPoint pictures that are in the book, right? Dead mountain lions, black bears and their baby cubs frothing at the mouth, dead in trees from ingesting these neurotoxins from grow. Pungy pits, Vietnam era pungy pits, anti-personnel for hikers and kids to walk into in national parks that, you know, my relatives fought in Vietnam and what a pungy pit is, you know, the Viet Cong putting out these bamboo stakes underground for our soldiers to fall into, unlike the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And seeing the AK-47s and the bad guys we caught and our dogs being stabbed and they're like, they're crying. I had growers like so outraged at that. They were crying their eyes out going, that's not us. We don't do any. And the water stealing and the pink toxic stuff in this water that they're taking out of these creeks and decimating these fisheries. They were heartbroken. You know, a percentage of them. And it made me realize, okay, well, then this is just a law that we're dealing with. We're dealing with a statute. These people aren't destroying the environment. They're just growing weed, making money. So let's get them in our backs. Mm-hmm. And they termed us their earth warriors and said, that's what we're about. And we're going to give this regulation a shot. We're going to come out of the dark. We're going to pay the money if we can afford it. We're now going to be overt. We're going to pay taxes, blah, blah, blah. And now they're getting run out. They can't afford to do it. So they're going back into the black market or getting out of the industry entirely.
How do they do, now that they've shown themselves though, how do they do that? Cause like they have their fields where they grow it and now we know where they are. They just suddenly like, we're black market now. Oh, yeah. Okay. No problem. Not coming in.
Or move operations, collaborate with somebody. A lot of them are just going into different markets as well. Mm. They're going into hemp production, non-THC content stuff that they can do regulated. They're going into, you know, other type of herbs, medicinal herbs that aren't on the cannabis spectrum. But when we watered that crime down in California for outdoor or indoor illegal growing from a felony to a misdemeanor and then made it an infraction for a juvenile grower, someone under 18, the cartels went, this is going to be great. Home free. Disneyland e-ticket rides all day long. I got a free pass. Well, when it was a felony and they could be arrested – on site, they've got guns, they're doing an illegal grow, they've got the poisons. We arrest them, it's a felony. So they're a deportable felon. If they're on a watch list, and many of them were and are that we would catch from the different cartel factions in Mexico, we could deport them. And now they're a deportable felon. They're going to be handled in Mexico through that criminal justice system, or we're going to prosecute them if they're not a deportable felon and they are a citizen, which very few were, through the justice system. Because of the felony statute, a misdemeanor, 6 plants illegal grown is a misdemeanor in California. 6,000 plants is a misdemeanor. So all these guys are going to do is they're going to get their plants ripped. They're not going to be prosecuted for that crime unless you have human trafficking and you get some real aggressive poisons that are felonies. And they're just going to outproduce law enforcement. They're going to rip 4 or 5 of their grows when they got 40 more going down the road. And it's kind of an attrition, a cost of doing business, cost benefit analysis.
Question though on that.
Try to answer.
Here's what I'm still a little confused about though. If you move it down to a misdemeanor and you catch a regular black market guy, Rob, doing this, who's just growing plants and whatever. Okay. Then you're only allowed to call it a misdemeanor. You can only take 6 of his plants. And just like you said with the cartel example, he's still got 40 behind here. So whatever, he wins. Right. When you catch the cartel guy, though, number one, usually they're here illegally.
Right.
Number two, they're carrying weapons that I'll bet you aren't registered with the California state.
Very
and
correct.
I know that's like a huge felony and whatever. So point being, like, isn't the weed crime kind of the least of your worries when you know you're going to catch them on fucking 12 other things anyway that are not changing from felony to misdemeanor?
Yeah. In good cases where we have all those felonies, they're going to go through and we're going to push it. But when we are – in a sanctuary state, which California became right as we were starting this team, we were told not to talk to federal agents. We were told not to talk to ICE or Border Protection that were embedded and on standby with us.
You're told not to talk with them.
Not to talk with them or share information. Now check this out. We're not only state law enforcement officers. I have a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ID. I am deputized federally when I get out of the academy. We can enforce federal regulations related to wildlife trafficking or anything related on a federal level. We're also mandated by policy to work with any federal agency that needs our help. If FBI calls me up and says, hey, Lieutenant, we got this murder investigation going that might have went down in a grow or it might have been around, let's say somebody was shot, maliciously in a hunting – not a hunting accident, but it happened in that situation. Of course, I'm going to do my due diligence. I'm going to work with that brother or sister, get them the information they need and solve the crime. And we were actually told, do not talk to ICE. This guy you have in custody, you got in a gunfight with. The book chapter goes into it on our last gunfight that I was involved in with my team in 2017 of the 6 we've been involved in. And it was mind-blowing. And that came straight down from governor's office down. My agency.
The great Gavin Newsom. He would never. Come on.
I don't
greatest
remember.
Greatest governor in American history.
Yeah. I don't remember if it was old Newsom or if it was Brown at the time, but I think it might have been our latest governor.
Those California values are very, very important. They're great.
So
nothing bad about them.
And two things going on. We have cannabis just got regulated and we want it to succeed because everybody saw the dollar signs, including our government, right? And every state that's mimicked California since, Maine, Michigan, Oklahoma, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, New Mexico, they're all having the same shit show right now. And I've been teaching and speaking and training these groups about, hey, this is what we did in California, why we formed up this unit. And this is the pitfalls we're having. And we are out there aggressively trying to fight the problem, but it is literally whack-a-mole, man. I mean, we're being outproduced and we're not stopping the problem. And I've always said, what's the solution? You have to look at everything that goes with illegal cannabis, not as anything against weed, but you have to put the felony back in it. That's the cartel's will slow the roll, or at least have a little bit of deterrence that, hey, you know, we're going to get arrested and we're going to get deported, or we're going to get actual, you know, in custody time. And we're going to add those additional crimes like banned poisons that are felonies, right?
Banned poison?
Yeah. The banned poisons and toxics that they put on that cannabis.
Oh, right, right.
Some of the pictures I have in Hidmore in the latest book, any of that guns, human that we see, right, inside all of these grow sites, that's what we need to do. We need to look at it as an environmental catastrophe, a public safety catastrophe, and just take weed out of it. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I was quoted.
Feels like the focus where it should. That's like missing the forest for the trees. No?
Right, right. People are automatically going, it's weed, we're going to turn away from it. You know, but I was quoted by the Associated Press, like, I don't know, a decade or so ago. And I said, look, if cherry tomatoes were on the black market right now and yielding $4,000 a pound, and the cartels were spraying carbofuran on it so an animal didn't even take a little piece of that real expensive cherry tomato, then we would be having these discussions and gunfights and public safety threats and all this other crime around cherry tomatoes. So take weed out of it. Just look at the incentivized money that's being made. And we know regulation doesn't work, at least the way we structured it, because now the black market is double, if not triple, quadruple what it was before we regulated in 2016. So all those naysayers that said, you guys are going to be out of a job. Now in California, as an example, over 100 game wardens are dedicated to the cannabis enforcement program. Not all of them are on the tactical unit, the MET unit, but there's all these different watershed teams that's all they do. And they're hitting, I'd say, optimistically 10% of the problem, probably much less than that.
All right. I have so many questions here and so many – I'm wondering how this all goes down, like everything you're saying across different agencies, like you've been mentioning, like task force and stuff like that.
Right.
And I don't want to get lost in that because I kind of want to come back to the beginning of where – like when you first got on the job and when you first noticed this
first
was a problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But real quick, the one thing I do want to stay with because it's come up like five times. That whole thing about the state telling you you can't communicate with federal officers. Now, I understand you work for the California state here. You're not a federal guy. You work for California Fish and Game.
Correct.
If you did communicate, though, with those federal officers, is that illegal? It feels like the state is circumventing, and I believe in state rights and everything. I understand some of the issue here, but like in this case, the state is purposely circumventing federal agencies' ability to do their job that they quite literally have jurisdiction over. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong at all. Julian, you hit it, bro, straight up on the head. That's exactly what happened. And it was because the depth of the cartel involvement in California was being underplayed. One, because legitimate cannabis was supposed to take that problem away, and this looked really bad for legal cannabis. And the other thing was, just like what we did on our southern border in this last administration, why did we flood it with tens, if not many, many more millions of illegal nationals coming up across the border, with a percentage of which are cartel operatives, or they're in grows, or they're doing trafficking, or they're doing fentanyl. Why would anybody logically allow that at an administration level? People say it was to ensure votes, you know, for this next election. That was certainly a discussion. But what is the rational reason for that? And there's many different, you know, answers and many different kind of factions to that. But when we were told that, that was something that came from the top, not even from our agency, from above our agency. And it actually wasn't something we were supposed to do in policy, because my question to the administrator that told me that, and my captain at the time said, I can't believe I got to tell you this, but that guy you guys just got in that gunfight with that survived, that was coming down on you with firearms on that grow raid, and a canine and one of my officers highlighted in this book that, you know, made a really good counter move as we shifted in that little battle so we weren't hurt. She said, you can't talk to ICE. You know, that guy is, he's, if he gets out of the hospital, he's not going to be handed over. We're not going to have anything to do with it. I'm like, okay.
Wait, you're not going to hand over the bad guy to ICE?
We're not going to do it. It's not.
You're just going to let him walk.
It's not our job. He's going to get a ticket. He's going to get a court date, and he's going to show up or he's not going to show up.
But what if ICE shows up and they're there and the guys?
They're going to grab him.
All right.
Good. Yeah. If ICE happens to be there, God willing, then good. They're going to handle their thing. They're going to deport. They're going to do what they're going to do.
How often did you break this rule?
Did I personally? Yeah. Oh, I didn't break it. But what I can tell
you is... Where you just, you know, slid over the notes and said, oh, look what I left there.
It would be
a shame if someone picked that up.
Yeah. What I can tell you is there were a lot of really dedicated ICE agents that were environmentally motivated and wanting to kind of, you know, draft what we were doing. And they stayed in the area and they were always on board, many times studying the same groups we were. So it didn't fall through the cracks.
Many
of these guys made it. We didn't have communication. Nobody wanted to lose their jobs or be disciplined. Obviously, it's one of those things, though, that this stuff we don't – I mean, it's not hidden what we do. We put out press releases, you know. Data gets generated on who's in custody, and it goes from there.
It basically makes your job, though, unnecessarily harder.
Well, it handicaps you. It hamstrings. Yes. I mean, okay. And it just – and when the public finds this out, they're like, how could that even – be possible with the damage this guy was doing environmentally and what that grow is doing. And on top of it, that particular grow site was in Santa Cruz County, just over from the Santa Clara County side. And a third of that 10,000 plant grow complex was on a children's science camp property. So these kids were going up in the summer learning to archery hunt, learning to wildlife ID, learning to track, learning vegetation, getting those skills, those confidence builders, you know, to learn the outdoors, kind of like Cub Scouts, Boy Scouts. And by the good graces, they had never had interaction with when this grow was going down. And then the other thing about this grow that made it so heinous is we had an inordinate level of like preparation from these cartel grow sites on that side of Santa Cruz County.
What do you mean?
Mindset, very aggressive,
okay.
Very fortified, some tactical awareness of where to set up their grows, where to set up their camps, blockades where they could set up an overwatch position with weapons, big weapons like AK-47s, shotguns, 45 pistols, you know, guys that were wanting to fight. We called the area Asshole Alley. Because every time we went in there for 4 years, guys, for 4 years, Julian, in a stretch, if we weren't taking guns off guys and not having to shoot or our canines were making really good apprehensions, we were getting into, you know, fisticuffs with guys that weren't giving up. I mean, it was a jungle. It was the Wild West out there. And I just knew it's going to escalate. And the reason that area got so aggressive is these cartel groups got really, really confident. Because after we regulated with Prop 64 in 2016, they go, oh, yeah, there's very few agencies that are actually going to work this now. Santa Cruz PD, the sheriffs, different groups, they're going to go to the mom and pop, check for the six plants. They're going to go to do dispensary inspections now because that's the focus. And they're like, hey, it's a misdemeanor now. We know how aggressive those things are. We've helped you guys out. You know, we've seen guns. We've seen the toxics. Yeah. We've heard about the gunfights you guys are getting in quite too often. It's not worth it for us. It's not the risk. Go do it. So that day that gunfight happened, and I go into the book in specifics, we got no help from anybody. It was a fish and game, marijuana enforcement team led mission. My buddies from Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office that I worked with in the early days to even get into, you know, help their help to make our own team. Great team, very aggressive. They got a real good canine kind of after our canine showed what they could do. I borrowed them and their dog and two of our canines. So we had three canines. I said, bring the pack, man. It's going to be a Wild West ride today. I had that sixth sense that when we were going into that mission, we were going to do everything we could not to have a gunfight, but it was going to get Western.
I love how there's like six federal agencies right there and they're like, best we can do is a sheriff and two dogs.
Yeah.
Like,
but you know what?
That's crazy.
And that was a sheriff's department from out of their jurisdiction. And I don't know if I was a local sheriff, I'd be like, that's embarrassing, man.
Yeah.
We're not going to help our game wardens, but these guys are, they're going to borrow, you know, really wired right sheriffs over on the Silicon Valley side.
I mean, good on them to help.
No, it was fantastic. They were brothers. We've been in a lot of scraps together. In 2005, when I had only worked with them a couple of times, and it was myself as a new lieutenant, two young wardens with me, three officers from the sheriff's office, brothers for life, all special forces, snipers, the whole nine. And then we got ambushed during a raid, August 5th, 2005. They were in full harvest. There were a couple of, you know, heavily armed cartel gunmen, at least a couple that were there defending the grow from anybody that comes into it. And my partner warden, just a year out of the academy, AK-47 round goes off as we're sneaking through the grow, enters his left leg and tumbles like a military steel core AK round does. Just tumbled through his inner left thigh and then tumbled right through his right leg. So he's bleeding out of four big holes. I'm returning fire. Another sheriff's, two other sheriff's deputies are now engaging a guy that's got a sawed-off shotgun pointed at me through the brush that I don't see, and another young warden that's next to me on his first grow raid. And if those brothers had not engaged this cartel suspect, this gunman, I'm not here to talk. If they had been a second too late, I would have never made it out of the woods, and probably another warden wouldn't have made it out of the woods. It was that crazy. One bad guy shot, three of us returned fire, and the domino effect in that 8 to 15 second gunfight, we're really lucky. And by the good graces, Mojo, as he's call signed in my books, survived that after your recovery. But we waited almost 3 hours for an air rescue to get him off that damn mountain, bro, while he's bleeding out. And we learned that day, and I didn't know it overtly, but you know, when you just kind of subconsciously, I knew it intuitively. I said, okay, this is not your typical bad guy poacher that we're going after. These are the worst of the worst. They're not from this country. They're running around with looking like, you know, Sandinista rebels. They're dressed the part. And this is that mission that morning was in the foothills above a little town called Los Gatos, an affluent suburb of the Silicon Valley. And as we're climbing the mountain on that 100-degree morning, we're looking down at Meta headquarters for Facebook and Instagram, Cisco, eBay, I mean, Oracle. And that's what we're looking at.
A bunch of guys were like, you need to let everyone come through the border because this is an open border country.
Yeah.
Tell that to my fucking bullet wound.
Yeah, exactly. But that day I knew, man, I said, we have a bigger fish to fry environmentally. Yeah. These guys, we didn't even, that was the exposure to the worst level of violence, what they're prepared to do for their cash crop. We didn't know about the poisons that were all over those plants because they dry invisible. We're running through it. You know, we have no idea what we're getting exposed to. We don't know, you know, what our dogs are getting exposed to.
You're 13 years into the job at this point. This is 05.
This is 05. I started in 92. So yeah, I'm at about the halfway mark.
Okay. And I just want to set the deck here just so that I understand like your timeline. Was this the first time you'd been exposed to the cartel thing, or had you already seen that?
We did one other grow in 2004.
Okay, that's what I want to go to.
Yeah.
So what happens?
Yeah, and that's the first book I wrote back then with the agency before the second book came out. It's called War in the Woods, and that is literally the first chapter. I'm doing the traditional stuff. I'm checking, you know, trout fishermen for taking too many trout and doing patrols and patrolling my district for poaching, mountain lion depredations that are killing sheep and cattle.
Which has been your life at this point for 12 years and that's it.
Yep. Started in Southern California 3 years down in Riverside County. Got Western, you know, spotlighters, gangbangers, going head on head with them. Got my learning curve 3 years out of my comfort zone because I was from Silicon Valley, born and raised. After the academy, I got shipped down to SoCal on the Inland Empire, Riverside, and it's Western. Mm. Big gang groups coming in from LA, getting out in the outdoors, you know, kind of over the mountain in Riverside County with AKs and spotlights, gill netting fish, killing wildlife, narcotic warrants. I mean, all of that stuff. Mm. And I'm taking them on at like 22, 23 years old. And my fellow wardens are doing the same thing. We're all young and new. And sometimes we're together. Sometimes we're doing it by ourselves, which that was a, you know, little bit of a pucker factor. But talk about throwing into the deep end of the pool, learning quick. Don't make those fatal mistakes. Then I go back home in 95, Gilroy, Morgan Hill, San Martin area where I grew up. And now I'm the warden there, and I would later become the supervisor, the lieutenant for three counties based out of that area. But in 2004, I get a call from a really good friend, family friend. His code name is GI, as he's described in the first book. He's a fisheries biologist. Same time I'm going to San Jose State, getting the criminal justice and the masters and doing that, getting ready for this job. He's doing fisheries, loves the wild outdoors, been hiking with us since second grade, always in the outdoors, savvy guy. He's studying like just on the edge, another ranch that's on the foothill side of Henry Coast State Park where I met that game warden. The story we had a little earlier, right? Yeah. Changed my life, the divine thing. Literally watersheds feeding that. And he calls me one day and he's been studying like these creeks for all these endangered species, frogs and steelhead fish that migrate from the ocean and come all the way up, spawn, leave and go back to the ocean. And steelhead are so close to being completely gone. They're federally and state listed as threatened and endangered species. And each steelhead that makes it is worth, I think today, $40,000 to $50,000 if you put a monetary value on them. And he's watching these creeks, studying them, writing his thesis. And one day he calls me up and he goes, dude, like one creek is bone dry. Somebody's has to have diverted the water. Something's going on upstream, man. I have no idea what, but my little, the fish fry that were just hatched, they're dead. They're, creeks dry, all these steelhead are dead, these red-legged frog, the watershed that anyone's using down canyon, it's gone. I'm like, that's weird, dude. It's April. I mean, it's watershed. It's like the end of winter and water's flowing great. All right, listen, hold on. Let me get my truck. I'm going to throw you in. Let's go check it out. Those were the days that you could have a ride-along. He was already listed as a ride-along with me sometimes. So that's what I did. Very wood savvy, unarmed, no gun, but very wood savvy. Put him on my patrol truck, go up to the top of the mountain, and it's like Grand Canyon, straight down 500-600 feet, maybe 1,000 feet into this canyon bottom. Beautiful, pristine creek we stumble on, which is the headwaters of everything he's studying for many miles below him. And we get down, we find where the water starts, and we find out where it ends, and we see what's up. There's like a man-made earthen dam in this little canyon making like a pool of water in the creek. And then it's all shrunk down to a drain hose. So a water hose, like a garden hose, is running down the creek. Everything below, Julian, the hose itself is now dry, which runs all year for these animals.
So you're like, where's this going?
And when I went up there, what am I thinking? I mean, I'm not thinking about foreign invaders just took our water and for like their little super camp. I'm thinking, okay, some rancher's up there and he needed water for his cattle. So maybe he diverted a creek he shouldn't have. That's what I would expect to see. I had no idea. So we go down the canyon. We're following this hose. And I've got an AR-15. You know, I've got my pistol. I have my cell phone. I have my radio. There's no coverage for either. We're in the middle of nowhere.
Your brain's still like, I'm not going to have to use this.
No, I'm not going to have to use it, but I'm prepared if I do.
Right. You
know, always try to be tactically savvy. We're by ourselves, so be prepared. You know, train for the best and expect the worst.
Mm.
Don't get caught with your, you know, pants down if you can avoid it. And he's behind me, my partner, and we're just working our way down the creek quietly. And again, it comes into being that hunter and just knowing something isn't right. Even though we didn't know we were going to run into what I'm about to tell you, we did it stealthy. We did it like we were hunting carefully and being quiet. And that's what saved our lives that day. No exaggeration.
What time of day is this?
It's like maybe 10, 11 in the morning.
Okay.
But in such a steep canyon, it's just shadows.
Yeah.
Right. And we're creeping down this bank and then we see the water hose just kind of peter out and continue down the channel. And pretty soon I see like marijuana plants on the left side of the bank and on the right side of the bank. And they're about 18 inches tall and they're just as far as the eye can see. And I'm like, this is fucked up. This does not belong here, man. What is going on? So I know it's an illegal grow, but I don't know who. I can see what they're obviously diverting the water for their plants, and that's what this whole, you know, shit show is about. But as we start to move, I see some movement down the creek, and here come two growers. And we're hugging the bank of this undercut of this creek out of view, guns up, my optics on it, like, what is going on? And these two guys come out, and they're in the green BDU, like Vietnam-era battle dress uniform, Latin males. You know, definitely not. They didn't look like they were from the area. And they are coming through, man. And the guy on point, I'm not kidding. The guy in front has like a machete and he's like looking at plants and kneeling down very carefully. And he'd stop for a minute. He'd look around real quiet to see if anybody was looking. He'd trim it. He'd fix a water line. The guy behind him had the long gun, had a machete and other things. And he's scanning like tactically and he's looking behind him. Those are skills of a tactical unit like we run, right?
Yes.
Like a SEAL team or a SWAT team. I'm like, and these guys are by themselves. They probably haven't ever seen another living human being or something would have happened. We'd know about this problem. So their situational and tactical awareness right now and being a tactical instructor at the time and going into those skill sets for many years previous, I'm like, this is not your typical poacher.
You're like, Sicario.
Yeah, I'm like, Sicario, what is going on here? And we just hid, man. We just hugged that bank. I kept my weapon up, and I thought, I really hope these guys don't see us because I knew right away they were going to engage. They weren't going to give up. I was probably going to get my first gunfight, and I had an unarmed civilian with me. I had no way to communicate with my agency unless I hiked way back up on the hill.
Yeah, how's your scientist buddy taking this all in when he sees this?
He's a tough MF, man.
Good for him.
Yeah, he's been rolling with my whole
group
of siblings.
You're in Jersey, you can say motherfucker.
Yeah, yeah, no, he is. He's a tough motherfucker, bro. And he's still doing, man, I say he's doing God's work out there as a freelance biologist all over the West Coast. You know how passionate you are about these issues, man. It comes out, which I just love. You bring it out in me and I'm reliving it again. You know, here I am retired operationally. And he has that same fire. And even though he's not an armed badge, he was like one of my best, like quasi game warden ride alongs, you know. He was like always out there. And if it wasn't riding with me, he was calling me up all the time. Dude, this guy's doing this. You wouldn't believe what I saw. Great eyes. Really confident out there. Not scared of a thing.
That's great.
And even not being armed, he's like, okay, well, I can get cover. I'll figure it out. You just tell me what I need to do. I mean, I almost felt, wait, is my gun coming out of my holster? So I got the rifle and does old GI, is GI covering me with my Glock?
Yeah, he's reaching over.
No, he didn't do that, but because I told him not to, but he's that kind of guy. You know, he would take a bullet for me, vice versa. He's a family brother. So we're hovering, being quiet, and these guys are creeping and they're getting closer. They got to about 15 yards, which,
oh, that's dangerous.
Not real far. And we were still hidden in the shadows. And if you don't move, even though we didn't have cover in front of us and I got the gun up, I mean, just the tactical thing is movement kills. Even when you're camouflage face painted, it's Fieldcraft 101.
Oh, yeah.
In sniper schools when I teach it or when we deploy to snipers and as hunters, as even as a kid, dad taught that early. He said, look, you're going to be all dressed right, but if you move too fast and something looks back and you suddenly jerk or you hit a twig, you're done on a hunt.
That's it.
And military wise, you might get shot by a two-legged predator. So we just held, and those guys, man, I could just feel them seeing us, and they didn't see us. And they got around to the bottom of the creek. They checked a couple plants. They looked both ways, and they slowly worked back and kept working plants till they were out of view.
How big? Could you tell at this point, like, how big this plantation was?
I saw several hundred when we led a team of narcotics task force guys that I would start to immerse in that world and bring everybody together. Once we got out of there, it was 7,000 plants. Which was massive then. We've had cartel grows that are 50 to 100,000 plants that take over a mile of a mountainside.
A mile?
If not more.
That's
no
incredible.
Exaggeration. And they're so well camouflaged that unless you are flying over them at just the right time to get the light just right, or you see it from, say, satellite imagery or any of the other techniques, or just scout in the right area, or a hunter or angler or hiker runs across it, which are some of our best informants, thankfully, when they get out of that stuff alive. It's hard to see.
How do you camouflage Mary Jane?
You know what? I'll tell you some really crazy.
Please.
Yeah.
Here's I don't know shit about this.
So I'll get back to that 04 story. Hold that pause.
Yep.
We'll hold that thought. But let's fast forward to couple years later. Those sheriff's deputies that were in that first gunfight with us, they had never worked with game wardens before, and they're like, wow, these game wardens, man, I'll take these game wardens. I'll take John and his boys over, you know, deputies that I don't even want to work with up here. And no diss on them, but because they're just comfortable in the woods. They love this shit. You know, they're quiet. It's
goddamn country killers.
They're country killers, you know, they're just quiet. They hold up, you know, they're in the woods all the time. And we would find a grow site in a place called Foothill Park that was in Palo Alto.
In Palo Alto.
And for many of our listeners and viewers, Palo Alto is the home of what university that's worldwide known? Stanford.
Yeah.
Okay, so Stanford University, go up in the western foothills in eyeshot of Stanford University in the Silicon Valley.
Oh, I thought you were going to say this was like a Stanford cartel experiment.
No.
You're really worried.
It was close. That wasn't happening to the best of my knowledge, but
imagine Huberman up there like, yeah, so Megalito's teaching me all about the fucking
those guys are hard up for tuition, man. I know those Ivy League schools are pricey, but man, now you're up in Foothill Park moonlighting.
Yeah, but this is in this is in Palo Alto, literally, like in the confines of it, you're saying.
Well, it's in the Palo Alto proper. It's okay. Out of Palo Alto, go up into, you know, Foothill Park, which is a city park up there. And 32,000 plant grow. 32,000 plant grow.
How many miles was that? Like three?
It was less than that from a square mile coverage, but it was about a square mile,
that's
give
huge.
Or take. It was huge. And the crazy part about it was it had all these paved and dirt hiking trails that everybody, Palo Alto residents, kids, you know, moms afterwards with their strollers would hike, and guys would mountain bike the whole nine. And that one had been in play at least 4 or 5 years, and we didn't find it. Nobody, a park ranger hadn't found it. And this is so close to the city. This is how clever, excuse me, and how much work these cartel guys will put into the Fieldcraft to disguise this multi-million dollar operation.
They do have a great work ethic. I got to give
them
that.
Oh, they do. They divert. We've had water pipes 3 miles long, gravity fed through Poison Oak underground. They have to run all that pipe, and they have a gravity fed. They irrigate like nobody's business. The best. I have nothing but respect for that work ethic.
Yeah.
In different.
A lot of discipline in the cartel.
Yeah, in different areas. You know, in another activity, but they were they actually had hinges and pulleys on the manzanita that would stay over the marijuana, right? So if we flew it from the air, it was just manzanita patches and oak forest. And then at certain hours, they would pull back the hinges, right, on these pulleys and open up the canopy so sunlight could get 2-3 good hours and then close them back up.
Guys, if you're still watching this video and you haven't yet hit that subscribe button, please take 2 seconds and go hit it right now. Thank you.
So when we were flying at certain times of the day, and we had great, great spotters in the sheriff's office. An old retired captain, I won't say his name, but I call him Eagle Eyes. He would be our guy. Get in the chopper. You're on an overflight today. I may or may not go. I can find it pretty well. You're Eagle Eyes. We knew something weird was going up there because it was weird traffic. There were weird reports of things smelling funny. You know, maybe people were smelling cooking stoves going off in this grow. Maybe they even were smelling, you know, cannabis during harvest time when it gets that good pungent scent. And we weren't finding it from the air. And finally, we just started using our noses to smell it and get up there. And we finally found this thing. When we raided it, and some of the pictures are in this book, they had lean-to cabins built into the side of a hill that was covered with leaf litter that I literally walked on a trail and thought I was walking by just a grass hillside. And it had, like, hog chicken wire in it. And I opened up a door.
Oh, my God.
And I walked in, and there's pictures in here that show two bunks, a kitchen cook that looked like a tunnel camp in like Vietnam. Whoa. And I can't tell you, we walked right by it. How many other hikers walked right by that thing or stumbled if they got that far into the grow complex? It was crazy. So I went, okay, that's how they're getting away with it. Now we got to look for that type of problem. And we got to, you know, satellite imagery was just starting, you know, Google Earth and stuff. We didn't have any of that in the early days.
This is like 06?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is very impressive that they had this whole thing that would go over it where you said it was basically like other shrubbery and other plants that look normal.
Create a mobile canopy.
Now that's amazing.
Yeah.
Good work, cartel. But, you know, you still said that every day they'd have 2-3 hours where they had to have it open for sunlight. And I'm almost surprised it took so long to find it. If you just do a flyover every day, aren't you going to get it at some point? Like, oh, that looks a little different today.
You would, but again, it comes down to resources and time. Those birds, $1,000 an hour to run one of our airships.
And you didn't have drones back then?
No, drones weren't a thing yet.
Yeah.
Drones weren't a thing, and Google Earth wasn't. Now, Google Earth, we would have captured differences. In Google Earth, you can do some great, great stuff. Yeah. With the satellite mapping we have access to that the public doesn't. Military level stuff. You can see trends of
terrorism. Oh, you got the military Google Earth.
We get some help.
Okay.
We get some help from all the right people in Counter Drug. We had one of the things that's really cool, you know, being in the Bay Area, we had Moffett Field right up the road, and we had the 129th Air Force, you know, Aero Wing Squadron, the PAFOC Blackhawk teams, that when they're not deployed fighting the GWAT, the Global War on Terror, they're back for Counter Drug Task Force work to work with domestic agencies in California and other states. They can't go run missions themselves, but they can go into the woods and back us up. We use their airships. So we were running, like when we started the marijuana enforcement team's pilot program to prove ourselves, because the chief gave us 3 months, said, all right, we're going to rock the political boat. I'm going to take the political heat. You're going to handpick the right guys, and you're going to have 3 months, and let's see what happens. Document everything you do. You're not going to do any other patrol. You're now that roaming strike team. You know, you're that unit. And we would work with, in Operation Pristine, in that 2013 window, Julian, we would have a PAFOC helicopter assigned to us because the military was looking for an operation to do for an entire month of August. Yeah. So we got the PAFOC, we got their ground guys, their crewmen, and I got to work, and, you know, they're brothers to this day, 7 Special Forces, Green Berets, in the woods with us on that Santa Cruz mission with the gunfight and the canine bite, all there in Asshole Alley. There we are with 7 Special Forces helping us out and our PJs with a helicopter on standby.
But let's see, how did you miss this your whole life? You're laughing over here like Santa Cruz is a fucking war zone, bro.
Dude, that is crazy.
Alessi, I wish.
Just because of the fact that Santa Cruz, if you go there, it's such a small, it's a surfing hippie town.
Yeah, totally. He's like the nicest guy. Look at him. Yeah.
And it's just like, you just think of stoners, surfers, like everyone's chill. And exactly. In the Redwoods, there's just operation.
And Alyssa, you know, if you just look up Highway 17, right?
Yeah.
You know that spot. And you look at all those mountains up there, even growing up there, bro, and hiking all around there and spending a ton of time in Santa Cruz, I would have to be a game warden and then get diverted into this cartel fight on the cannabis to even realize some of these things. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And the Soquel Creek. All that watershed down to the coast.
That's right by where I lived.
Right. Yeah. And you didn't know.
He's like, wait, those were cocaine traffickers? I thought they were the gardeners.
They were the gardeners. You didn't know that was your big steelhead run right there in Soquel Creek.
One of the last
good ones on the West Coast was right there being impacted by these assholes the whole time. Yeah. I mean, probably going back to the, you know, early 2000s, if late 90s, before we even stumbled on this, man. Yeah,
fucking Cartella Cruz over here. Wow.
Yeah. So, that was an eye opener and, you know, finding it and going in and realizing, hey, if this is in the, you know, in eyeshot of Stanford now, and we'd had a gunfight in eyeshot of the Silicon Valley tech capital and the biggest companies, these guys are bold. They're anywhere. And keep in mind, we still had the felony statute then. So, and we were working them hard, but to your point, you had a really good question, Julian. I don't want to lose that, and all this other good stuff. If we could fly 24/7 or be up on all daylight hours, great. We would find a lot more. We would have found that grow. Yeah. We just can't. You know, I mean, to get a ship up a couple times a week, because one airship isn't just for that. It's for every different SWAT operation, night operations, tracking stolen vehicles or chasing people down. Those birds we were having to use from Sheriff's Office, San Jose Police, CHP. And then when we have a military bird, they're a lot to operate. So you're lucky to get a pave hawk, you know, a couple times a month, unless you're on a dedicated mm-hmm. operation. So, and they know that. It's just an attrition thing. And we found a lot. But they also know we can't be out there 24/7, and we didn't know how overproduced we were and how many were going on. We were, in those days from 04, I'm going to say till about 2010, 25 to 30 legitimate massive cartel complexes in Santa Clara County.
In one county?
In just my home county, in one county. Not counting Santa Cruz, just go over the hill and find another 20 or more.
This would never happen in Jersey. I just want to put that out there.
No, it never happened.
It would never happen in Jersey.
Yeah.
We don't let that shit here.
Yeah. I don't want that shit here either.
But that first one though, where you're with your biologist friend yeah. and you see the two guys and then they walk by and you're
yeah.
like, you go back to base, like,
oh man,
what are you like, boy, do I have a story for you? Like, well, what happens?
There was a lot to that, because we're going to go straight up this mountain and it's a grind. We're just going to power out of there as fast as possible, in pretty good shape, but getting our asses kicked. One, to get distance, because one, I got to start processing who I'm going to call, and I got to get in comms and talk to some people, my administrator first, my lieutenant at the time, my boss, and then start talking to other agencies. And it took about a good 45 minutes to an hour going double time, killing ourselves up that mountain. And I looked at GI and he looked at me and he goes, your wheels are spinning. What's next? I go, I think our shift just changed, at least on this. I'm sure I'm going to be involved in some level, but dude, I don't know. I got to talk to the narcotics task force guys. I know some of them. We've never done anything together. We're game wardens. They're doing white dope stuff. They're doing some marijuana I've heard about. We're not part of that. But you know, the best relationships of what I would consider the best part of my career, the second half, that I think the most relevant, at least for me personally, and the men and women that worked in that realm of special operations, that one mission built the bonds, right? Because when this task force came to run this operation, and there I am in another game ward, and we're going to be the bird dogs and take them down the same trail, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to say, okay, just get to the back of the line. We got this. Fine. I get it. It's, you got that notion of who we are, and I don't know what you do yet. So it's cool. We're going to do it safe, and it's professional courtesy. And then, but I would meet guys like Call Sign Snake, Apache, Ranger, all these guys that were sheriff snipers from the Santa Clara County Sheriff's Office that came to that mission as guests.
And they weren't
primary. They were brought in by the task force. And we would end up by the end of the day going, looking at each other and going, would you have done it that way? No. Would you have done it that way? No. We gave chase to two guys and nobody wanted to chase them. I could have run them down. I think you could have run them down. You look like you're in really good shape. Mm-hmm. You know, so-and-so. Yeah. And then I was told, hey, we have a marijuana eradication team. It's just two lead officers. We borrow, we'd like to work with you. What do you think? And I went, yeah, let's do this.
Sheriff's office.
So the guys I met that day in 04 were the same guys that were on the Hill when we had the shooting in 05 when my partner was shot near fatally.
Yes.
And that day, because they were so wired right, and you know, one of them's from Pennsylvania. A lot of guys are from back east hunting deer, and they have big outdoor backgrounds, military veterans that have fought in Beirut, had fought in the global war on terror. Mike D'Amigo, God rest his soul, who passed away way too early just a couple years ago. Apache, he was one of their lead snipers. He was just tickled. And I met him for the first day of that shootout in 05, and he saw this M14 I had. He went, is that a real military M14 game warden? How do you even get those?
I was unfamiliar with your game.
He goes, I didn't know what you guys were about. And, you know, friends for life, man, brothers. But we would form that bridge that after this first mission went not the way we wanted it to, we just became an informal team.
Wow.
And we started developing tactics to chase down bad guys before we had dogs. Light runners, I would be one of them. My fellow marathoners, you know, would strip down to just light armor, a light camelback, handgun, taser only, have riflemen supporting us. And if these guys get close enough and they start to run and we can do it safely and not get in a gunfight, we're going to tackle them, take them down. And then that got pretty hairy. And then, you know, we had a couple of real close calls where there were guys that had guns that we were about to launch and jump and run on. And all of a sudden the shotgun comes out and the gun plays on all around us. Yeah. It's rifle on rifle. I'm like, ooh, that was close. And then dogs changed the game, which the books go into. Canine Phoebe, who's passed now, was a Belgian Malinois, same type of dog SEAL teams use.
When did they come in, the dogs?
She started really popping in and working with her handler, Lieutenant Boyd, old Rumble, as he's called in the book, up in Shasta County, 06, 07.
Okay.
And
so you're a couple years in.
We're a couple years in. And he's doing that up north, and I'm not working with him. I trained him in the academy. He was a friend, but we hadn't worked together. And then other guys in like the Fresno, Central Valley, those mountains in the kind of the central part and foothills of California were doing some things. And Nate in the book, who I would later collaborate to build the marijuana enforcement team with the blessing of our chief, Mike Carrion, that's when we would find the people that were doing this work really well in their own little areas, but nobody was communicating and nobody was doing, you know, we weren't doing a structured,
yes,
organized, uniform way. The training, the weaponry, how everybody was going to be. So it was starting to go in that direction. And it took a long time to get to the point where we could actually have a team, and you know when that happens. So.
Yeah. So you basically, this task force idea first comes mm-hmm. up after that 04 sighting. Now, prior to that 04 sighting, though, because you've been doing your job that didn't involve the cartels, but all the other parts of the fishing right. game. Like, had you had shootouts or close calls or anything like that? Or was it 12 years or more standard, you know?
You know, I had a lot of close calls, but I never had to actually engage, thankfully. Okay. And that was just as a right out of the academy. I mean, I was talking about being in Riverside County. And I'm running into, unbeknownst to me, I'm by myself. I'm calling for backup. I got people coming because I've got a guy working a spotlight in a truck down like an area called Canyon Lake, but in a rural part of Riverside County. And they're lighting, and I'm hearing gunfire, and they're shooting animals, everything they see, rabbits, deer, coyotes, whatever. And then they're parking at the end of like a spillway and going dark for a while, and I'm doing my
– A spillway?
Yeah, like the back end of a dam where there's a runoff on the bottom of it, like a release valve of a little lake. And, well, that starts a creek that's going to have a lot of wildlife potential in it or concentrated fish. So these gangbangers basically from L.A. are poaching on the way in with their AKs and spotlights and all their pistols and killing anything that walks or crawls. And they black out at the end of this lake spillway and go dark. And I stay way away and just watch, blacked out. And unbeknownst to me, they're putting out a gill net to trap all the fish coming and going, to just gill net them up and take them back to LA, maybe to sell, maybe to eat, who knows. And when I go and make that stop and I darken out and crawl in behind them and then all of a sudden light them up with the red and blues and get on the PA, it's just me. And I don't realize there's 7 or 8 gang members in that truck, and they're rolling out. I'm calling them out one at a time and proning them out for a felony car stop. And I'm like 22 years old and I'm going, okay. By the numbers, man, like I was trained, guns on them, calling it out, staying confident, and just waiting for backup. And that night, no exaggeration, there was nobody even close. Riverside County Sheriffs knew I was new in town. And that's one thing game wardens got to do, brother. We work such a big area, like you said. All of a sudden, we're assigned to an area. we're getting to know the sheriffs. We're getting to know the Forest Service Rangers. We're getting to know the police officers, right? Because we're going to help them and they're going to help us.
Yeah.
You know, law enforcement resources. We saw this with the defund the cop BS running. We saw it through COVID. We got to be force multipliers. We're all understaffed to some level, mostly throughout most of the country. And Riverside wasn't close, so they sent their helicopter. So here comes this police helicopter from Riverside County. I hadn't even worked with these guys yet, with a spotlight on the bad guys, and they're kind of giving me this perimeter. The whole crew of gangsters were pretty compliant at that point. And I'm just going, I got to get back up, man, because I think I have 5 sets of handcuffs in this truck, 3 extra, 2 on me, and there's 8 dudes.
Well, what about the zip ties?
Yeah, I got 2 of those. All right, there you go. I'm going to go to those.
That'll do the trick.
We're going to get on it. But I had the help, and then units arrived, and I realized, okay, this isn't just checking fishermen. It's not just checking nice guys with guns. Those are most of them.
Right.
Yeah. So I had probably 20 close calls where it was borderline, coming close to having to shoot because somebody wasn't giving up a gun, or they would be on narcotics or that kind of thing. But nothing that was so intentionally violent somebody being in a grow and dressed a military type part, being involved in what we would later learn as a transnational criminal organization.
But when you see that in 04, you didn't get into the gunfight right there. But
right.
When you're going back and then this task force is getting set up and stuff, I mean, this has got to be somewhat of a baptism by fire for you, where you're
absolutely.
Like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Like now I may, like when I go out, I might be shooting.
Yeah.
Like that's setting in.
More. Now. I look at it as more likely than not, because that's a specific – that's not something any patrol – a patrol warden isn't going to do that job and shouldn't. A patrol deputy on a sheriff's office isn't going to just drift in and take on a grow or shouldn't. That's a more specialized thing, that a military or SWAT unit would do. And we didn't have that formal military or SWAT unit, so we were kind of an ad hoc team with other agencies, and it was awesome until we got to where we had to get. And we were really lucky to do that, and that started in 2013 and as Hidden War goes into, just a mind-blowing experience of not only the missions, but having the resources to do the job, having that canine Phoebe and dogs I can't mention by name that are still operational that replaced her.
I love that we got undercover dogs now.
Yeah.
We can't disclose them. They're clandestine purposes.
We don't.
Someone's going to be like, oh, her name's Maddie. We'll call her out. Maddie, get the fuck over here.
Get over here.
That's John's fault for saying it on a fucking podcast.
Damn it, Julian. You made me talk. I love it. But no, that would lead to what we needed to be.
Yeah.
And now that team's still, they're overwhelmed with the way the regulation structure is. And it will hopefully change down the road. But
not according to Newsom's California values.
He doesn't want it.
He doesn't want to change it.
Nope.
He's already said Trump's the body's not even cold yet. He's not even in office yet, and they're already doing that.
Yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, yeah. So that's where we're at. And now just trying to really get the big picture out.
Mm.
So then I was focused on the cannabis problem, right?
I'm sorry to cut you off, John.
No,
I just don't want to lose this in the middle of it. You talked about that story in 05 before people knew the full context.
Right.
Can you just take me back there for a second and the build up to that? So this was the first shootout.
Yeah.
You've already laid out what happened. Your buddy took like straight through both legs and everything, like crazy shit.
Yeah.
But what was going on in the days leading up to that and then actually getting there? Like, did you expect that to go down?
Yeah, that's a good question. We always thought it could go down. We always prepared for it to go down, but we had never had any grower combat us. The sheriffs hadn't. In fact, I don't think anybody in the country at that point, I know no one in the country at that point, any agency, had had a grower hit an officer with a firearm in an attack. No one had been shot. And the fact that that happened that day and it was a game warden naturally got a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah.
It got a lot of attention from our governor. It got a lot of attention from a lot of news crews. We had national news crews there, like all 3 days into the weekend. It was on a Friday. They secured the site. It had to go, it was a long drawn out thing that brought a lot of attention to, game warden near fatally shot. You see him being airlifted out, the whole nine yards. And then the question comes up, what are game wardens doing on a drug raid? That's not their job. And now our director and our chief, Nancy Foley, at the time are getting a lot of political heat from the governor's office, but they're like, hold on. It is our job. The biggest environmental crimes we're seeing against water and poisoning with poisons we don't even understand yet are happening in these cartel grow sites. That's our mandate. That's like the forte, what game warden should be doing. So she held the ground and fought that, and that kept us involved. That day going in, we had our weaponry, we had all our kits, you know, stealth, stalking, camouflaged. One thing we didn't have enough of, and this was a big debrief and a big learning lesson for us and the sheriff's office moving forward, was the latest and greatest trauma medical supplies that were, you know, being developed and used over in the sandbox. Like the anticoagulant quick clot for
the sandbox,
Desert Storm, Desert Shield, Afghanistan, Iraq.
You say that like I'm going to know that. Yeah. Come on now. I'm a goddamn civilian.
You are. My bad. But yeah, we finally refer to it as the sandbox.
The sandbox. Oh my God.
Those guys that have fought over there, not me, but the veterans I worked with on the team, they joke about it that way. But yeah, we didn't have enough trauma supplies that day.
Mm.
You know, we didn't have anticoagulant. We didn't have enough tourniquets. None of that trauma medicine technology or knowledge was being put out to anybody but specialized SWAT type units and special forces groups. That changed immediately after that gunfight. We didn't have enough people. We should have had more officers for a grow. We didn't know it was as big as it was. We had a scout. We had rangers helping us. We thought it was, you know, 7,000 to 10,000 plants at the most. More like the 5,000 to 7,000 mark. And then when we went up in there, that grow that we encountered the bad guy and got in the gunfight with, where my partner got injured near fatally, later when all those tactical teams would come to back us up and we're getting off the hill and getting him to the hospital, and now we're being debriefed and interviewed for our first gunfight, which I hadn't been involved in, and that was a long day away from my partner in the hospital going into emergency surgery. Now there's like up to 10 other grow complexes on that mountain
right there. Yeah.
And guys that I work with are coming in from other parts of the state, setting up a night vision in the mountains, just hearing these guys trickle out, trying to grab everybody they could. That mountain was taken over by the cartel. It hadn't been touched in probably a decade.
This cartel is just running an entire mountain in California. No problem.
Yeah. It's open space. It's county land that doesn't see much, you know, people, because it's very remote. Even rangers they seldomly go in there. And that's why they got away with it so long. Wow. And it was really hard to detect.
You know what I keep picturing in my head is like a parallel image. You ever watch True Detective?
Love, especially the first season.
Yeah, first season is probably the greatest season.
One of the best shows on television.
Yeah. So that in like episode 4 or 5 of that season.
Yeah.
When Rust and Cole happen upon that meth.
Yeah,
cabin
that
or
big
whatever.
Eerie encampment
and
back
they,
there.
And yeah, they come through like these woods, and it's all like quiet, and then suddenly open up the bush, and it's just like a dude naked in a mask, like walking around and cooking meth, and they're like, "What the fuck?"
That was the cliffhanger into the next episode. Yeah. Blew my mind. Yeah, that's
like,
the vibe.
That's what I keep picturing with you, where you're just like in the middle of the wilderness. Oh, look, a mountain lion! Holy shit, cartels!
Yeah.
Like, whoa.
You know, that's probably the best analogy I've heard anybody say. Because that was the shock factor. It was like something you don't expect, even though it's your natural operating environment where I'm the most comfortable. I mean, put me on a trail in quiet woods somewhere to deal with bad people or to, you know, deal with problem animals, whatever the case may be. That's our comfort zone. And that was very uncomfortable to see what we saw that first day in 04.
Whoa.
Yeah, for sure.
So after the shootout, you mentioned the one in 06 is the camouflage example where they would cover it all up and everything. Did you ever end up in a shootout at that one?
No.
You didn't?
No, that one, the guys, we ended up catching a bunch of guys away from their guns, and we found a bunch of guns in that little encampment that was, you know, kind of that hut in the side of a mountain.
Yeah.
Fortunately, that one did not get violent because we had so many civilian groups, you know, around and in the community that was there. Everybody was safe on that one, but we had two more in the Saratoga and like Cupertino foothills, again, another affluent west side of the Silicon Valley, where guys just were, you know, running around with guns. We're going to make our approach with our light runners, and they're pulling guns on us, and we had no choice.
They're pulling guns on you, so you got to shoot them.
Yeah, because they're going to kill us otherwise.
Some of these involve kills.
Yeah.
Where you're taking guys out.
Yeah, those were of the gunmen we encountered in those two. Yeah, those gunmen were killed. And then in the one in 2017, that gunman was injured, not fatally. And then
way later
in 2017. We had six total combined, either individually or collectively as a team, starting with the one in 05 where we had a game warden shot. And that's where the eye-opener realization of what we were dealing with, obviously, was a whole new world. And with that, Julian, that's when we got more training. We got the support from administration. If you're going to stay in it, now we could go do what we needed to do.
Is this under Governor Terminator at the time?
No, unfortunately, it wasn't. It was he came in right as that was starting.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was great. It was great in that window when he was there. And ironically, one of the things as a result of that gunfight in 05, fast forward to 07, when Arnold Schwarzenegger was our governor. Yeah, the so governor. Good. When he was our governor in California for that window, myself and the other warden that were involved with our partner that was shot, we were basically honored with the Medal of Valor from the governor's office. It's California Governor's Medal of Valor, and law enforcement annually will receive this for certain things that have happened. But what I remember, I mean, the award is fine, but it was what the narrative was around the award that got read publicly, that the governor got wind of, what happened in this, well, you got AK-47, mm-hmm. This kid got shot by a gunman that's from a transnational criminal organization. I translate a cartel out of Mexico. What the hell? And that was just one of the things, you know, you just keep drawing attention to it, yet policies won't really change. And this thing, this lack of, you know, mass word involvement in education and spreading the word wide, like we're doing on these podcasts now, it just wasn't happening. We had that happen. We did two documentaries with Patriot Profiles, NRA's Life of Duty, my good friend Rick Stewart with American Zealot Productions, who was working strictly for Outdoor Channel and for the National Rifle Association, said, hey, I just got wind of this shooting you guys had and cartels.
Wait, they were letting you do documentaries as a government organization?
At that point.
That's kind of cool.
It was great.
Yeah.
Because we had a good governor, and we had Nancy Foley, our chief of patrol, our first female chief, and awesome. One of my mentors, fantastic. And she said, yeah, you know, I think if we can do it safely, we should do a documentary in there. But you have to be comfortable with the team, and I want you to make sure you make yay or nay it. And that's how we ended up doing it. And I made really, really good friends starting in, you know, Special Forces and veterans. And Rick Stewart, I want to mention by name because he's just, you know, brother for life, great guy. Retired Air Force Siri instructor, search, evasion, rescue, and escape, you know, resistance and escape. Yeah. He was one of those guys that waterboarded all the soldiers, you know, that to train to survive. Great guy. And he was running this for 11 seasons, award-winning, just documentaries on, like, you know, your canine for veteran PTSD, smoke jumpers, the Adam Brown story of the Christian SEAL Team 6 operator that was killed in action right before his team went out and did the Osama bin Laden raid. Wow. Rick did some good stuff. And at least, like I said, those are all on my YouTube channel in full and teasers. And you guys can use any of that.
Oh, great.
Yeah, any of that. Rick's that kind of guy. He just wants to help out.
By the way, we'll have the links to your books as well as your YouTube channel down in the description below so people can click that because you're obviously the whole day we're referencing all this. So go check out the man's work.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Of course.
Yeah, we're not going to get into all of it, but we give you some teasers. So with those documentaries, we were getting some good word out. We did 3 years of a game warden reality show called Wild Justice on National Geographic.
Oh, yeah.
From 08 to 2010.
So it's really heating up now, getting attention.
We're getting attention. It's heating up. We're not our own Met team, but you see Brian Boyd and Phoebe, and you see me and our guys down in Santa Clara County now, working with film crews from National Geographic for worldwide exposure, and we're going into cartel grows. And the sheriffs were great. They actually agreed to do it because we got to go with them. It's their mission. We're assisting them. So we get it out on national television, actually international television, bro, and everyone gets all outraged. They see the episode. They go, that's mind-blowing. It's exciting. Oh, my God, I had no idea. And you think, okay, this is going to be really cool. We're going to start seeing teams built. We're going to see funding. We're going to see some awareness. Now we're starting to learn about the poisons, the carbofuran, the metaphos that these guys are importing and spraying all over the weed and in the water.
How are they getting it in? Just like taking it across the border like everything else?
They are. You know, what's crazy is growers down in central Mexico, good ones, get themselves vetted down there. So basically, say Sinaloa's got all the marijuana they're producing down in Mexico, and they bring up growers that are really good. Water diversions, keeping the plants alive, right? Keeping them hidden so they don't get interdicted. And when those guys get really good, then they get pushed up to California or another state.
It's and like their college.
Yeah, it's like their apprenticeship.
Go get your PhD now in California.
You did your master's, you did your apprenticeship, you're a journeyman.
There you go.
Go, baby. But yeah, those guys get really good. Then they get put up here. And the only thing they got to bring with them are the poisons because they can't get the poisons here. But suppliers are already in setup, weapons, sleeping, food, cots, tents, camouflage paint, all the water pipe they need from various different landscape suppliers. That's all ready for them. But these growers are so good at what they do and the cut they make. There's significant money in it. And something I was privileged to sit in on, and I talk about this in, I think, the fourth chapter of this latest Hidden War, was we interdicted a guy that was a Plaza Boss level grower. And
a what?
Plaza Boss level grower. So in a cartel organization, you have a Plaza Boss, and they oversee a plaza or a territory that's fairly
Plaza Boss.
Oh, yeah.
I was very confused.
I don't have enough of that Jersey accent, bro, to get that plaza.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, wow.
Yeah. So this guy got popped on a 22-pound meth cook, which is typically what they're doing. They're doing these super cooks that are 22 pounds now from these super labs. He wasn't cooking, but his boys were. And he got busted with a bunch of, some of his colleagues. Mm. And, he wasn't a Sicario killer. He was very businesslike, very cordial to deal with. And he was debriefing with us, obviously. And DEA and the team that brought us in, because he was popped for something else. But I got to sit in on that debrief with the sheriffs and with DEA, which was mind-blowing. I got to ask him questions.
What did you ask him?
I asked him things that I thought were trending differently, where we were making an impact from the standpoint of these grow sites that we'd raid, right? Catch bad guys, don't catch bad guys. Take out all the plants, hopefully safely and not get contaminated, but go through the protocols so those never make it to the market because they're basically hazmat now. All that infrastructure, all the water diversions, all the decimation of the forest, what now? Who's cleaning this up? Who's redirecting the water? Who's taking, stabilizing the banks of this mess of a creek? Nobody was. Drug teams hit it. Well, that's not our job. We're not garbage collectors, man. Mm-hmm. We're out. So we were pushing the reclamation side. And at that point, Julian, we were starting to reclimate and clean up and restore these grow sites as best we could on the day of the raid or like in the winter months shortly following. And I wanted to ask him, hey, man, so if we raid a grow and take your guys, take your plants, we don't take that stuff out. The water diversions are still there. Or if we pull them out, they could be put back right in and you can have instant unlimited water, depleting this creek for these plants. We don't take out your fertilizers. We don't take out, your camping equipment, your food. It just stays out there like a waste site. And I said, but if we clean it up and we take all that out, does that honestly make a difference to you guys? And what he told me, he kind of laughed and he said, you know what? Up until recently, we never saw that happen. And he was overseeing approximately 50 grow sites in NorCal.
Oh.
In addition to doing this other stuff. So, and some of those grows, probably a good percentage of those grows we had been part of taking out. And he said, and it was shocking to see all this stuff cleaned up. Cause if it's not cleaned up, we know how taxed you guys are. And we know it's a 50-50 if we wait even just one more season, if we set back up in that same area, 50% chance we're going to get our grow out to market.
Wow.
That's how much he knew how overworked and understaffed and how to play the game. Again, cost-benefit analysis, right? Business model. The resources are there. I put 30 to 40K into all this infrastructure. If they don't clean it up, I don't have to put that back out there. And I got trap doors. You guys hear the guys coming. 9 times out of 10, you're not going to get caught. Go for it. But he said, when I started to see these pristine sites, we're like, what are they doing? They're cleaning the forest now? Well, now, 9 times out of 10, they won't go back to that spot no matter how good the water is or how good the angle, that south-facing slope where they're going to put their plants. Now it's a good spot. It's a spot they don't want to touch because they're like, well, not only is it on some database – that some agency hit it, whether it was Met from Fish and Wildlife or somebody else. But now I got to lug all that stuff back in there. I got to divert a creek. You guys have already restored it. And that's a lot of money and time,
right,
on a 50-50 or maybe less that we're going to make it out of there. So the light bulb went off and now we started to convince DEA that when you're funding the counties and every state gets funded by a DSIP. It's an acronym, said, you know, pronounced DSIP by the Drug Enforcement Administration. Every state gets, and every county within a state gets, a certain amount of money under the Drug Czar's budget to deal with counter drug. And in cannabis, it was how many plants you eradicate dictates how much money you're going to get. But how many bad guys you catch or guns you seize, very little reward for money.
Hmm.
There was no money for environmental reclamation or cleanup at all. So if we went out and just ripped, like the task force, when we ripped those 7,000 plants in 04 on that first raid with GI, they're like, hey, man, we're bringing in a PAFOC from a Moffett Field. You're going to ride up, you're going to hoist into a military black op. I'm like, that's cool, but what about all this shit that's left behind, man? They're like, oh, no, no, we don't do that. Because they're looking count, 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 plant, count, plant, count, and that's going to get me my 250K or whatever instead of 100K that I got it. That's my budget.
For yeah, bad incentive structures, basically.
But it changed, bro. The cool part was we got it in front of the DSEP coordinator's eyes. We got it in his on his radar, if you will. And he's like, you know, I see what you guys are doing here, and this is important. And federally, even though we're not a conservation agency, we see the decimation of the water, especially. And these poisons are bullshit that they're getting in here and all over the site. So they started to incentivize for tons of trash removed, you know, banned poison amounts by the gallon or whatever. And I go into this in the book and beyond of all the meticulous records we started to keep as a, you know, a delineated, dedicated team. Every plant we got a number. So, you know, in 6 years, it was 3 million tainted cannabis plants that this team eradicated and removed. 3 million, that's a lot of freaking plants.
That's a lot of plants.
And that's only one team. That's just our little fish and game team. That's not counting all these other teams that were around California and in other states doing similar work. I think we were at 900 or so felony arrests, right, on cartel gunmen, growers, or combination in 6 years. That's a lot of bad guys with good skill sets from the organization, from across the border, right? I don't know, 400 or maybe it was 4,700 tons of waste. And now start to get rewarded for that. And it actually deters these guys from going back in there. When we could convince mainline agencies that aren't conservation or cleanup guys that you're actually going to deter this for your public, and it's a good, good selling point of why we're doing this job, then we were starting to make a dent. Force multiplier with other agencies.
Did there come a point where you were able to start to cultivate confidential informants?
A little bit, yeah.
From inside the organization?
That was next to impossible. I would say that Plaza boss that I got to talk to for several hours, he was the best and he was the most accurate.
Yeah.
Because of the situation we were in, and here's why. Why it's so hard to get intel unless you see it firsthand is – take a terrorist cell like Al-Qaeda where if you have one operative that's doing one thing and he has a burner phone with a number to his boss that he has a first name only of, and it's going to change when that burner phone changes, you don't really know exactly who you're working for. You can't actually give it up if you are debriefed or caught.
That's right.
And that's exactly, brother, what we had the problem of doing. We caught a ton of growers, and some of them spoke English, and some of us had enough passable Spanish on the team to, you know, do some interpretive, but it's like, I just know a first name. And he's not lying, you know, and this is how I'm paid and this is how I'm dropped off. Everything is compartmentalized, very intelligently, very structured. So it was very hard to get intel. We got a lot of intel in grows with growers we caught, especially if there was a boss there for the day or there were some of these armed gunmen guys that, you know, we didn't get in a gunfight with that we could get something from, or we could, you know, get evidence like a phone that actually had some stuff on it. We would take all of that. And then the technology got much, much better to analyze phone data, deleted right. stuff, pictures, you know, coordinates and things like that. And we started to see that when we started to get this stuff off growers inside grows, it's like, wait a minute, what's this? Where's this house? This looks like Northern California. We're
yeah.
in, you know, Santa Cruz County today. And then we would see signs of, say, a meth operation, or you would see people that might have hinted at some sort of human trafficking thing based on data where people were going. So at the end of the day, very difficult to get something from all of these growers, but we got enough, I think, over the years to at least verify and validate what we thought we were seeing.
You knew they were telling the truth.
Yeah, this guy was.
Even when you waterboarded him?
Yeah. He was, man.
John's like getting the bucket. He's like, no, yeah, take me back.
He was tough, man. I got arm pumped from like, it was too many buckets. You know, Julian, five gallon. It's 8 pounds per gallon of liquid. You put five. That's 40 pound curls.
Fill you up. Yeah.
Do 50 of those. I don't care how. You know, after I've done an arm day,
it's a good workout.
Yeah.
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 Ever since I saw Denzel do that for real in Safe House, I'm like, I can do it.
Yeah.
I could take it.
I can do it. I can do it. I could at least do it two or three times, you know, if I've got the conditioning on the arms. Yeah, not in our scope, but yeah, man, it was,
but basically
just mind blowing.
They have it set up in such an organized, compartmentalized way that they make your job really tough because there's deniability everywhere. So it's almost like you find these huge plantations, whatever the hell you want to call them, these plazas. And they are a part of this huge RICO transnational conspiracy, but they're just one little expendable peg on it because they can, all right, you know, it's a business expense. They lose a couple here because, oh, there's a couple good law enforcement officers. They figured it out. No problem. We got 30 over there.
Yeah.
They don't know about those ones.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we were starting to make the link as, especially when the team started in 2013 that, you know, we were working larger cases or working with agencies that were working larger cases of following, like finding a plaza boss like this guy was, seeing what he was doing in the dope grows, but then finding all the other things he was involved in, like having business fronts for money laundering, being part of human trafficking or running a meth operation. And this is right before fentanyl suddenly became the big cash attractant crop cow for these guys, right?
What years are we in right now?
We're getting to like 2012, 2013, like right on the precipice of going formalized with the marijuana enforcement team, with my unit. And now we're still concentrating on, we're handling the weed on the environmental front, but now we're realizing the term polycriminal comes in with my federal colleagues, especially DA. And you look at it like, so this guy that's in this grow today and say he's running the grow. He's not a plaza boss, but he's running the grow. He's, everyone's working for him. He's processing, he's growing, he's watering, he's trimming. He's starting to, you know, get that out. He's working with somebody right next door that's leading the meth charge, right? In the winter and in the summer, doing these 22 pound meth cooks, the super meth now that's just nasty. And then that guy's working side by side with the guy that's bringing dirty fentanyl pills from labs. And he's got all of his, you know, infrastructure in place on how he gets across the border, you know, kind of like you and Jorge talked about, the Chinese operatives coming across with clean passports, very cleanly cut military age males, and they're all set up. They're running a whole different scheme on how they're getting by. It's costing the, you know, them a lot more money to get across. Same type of deal. And now this guy's, you know, responsible for fentanyl distribution in the Northwest of 7 or 8 states. It's all sectionalized. So when we're fighting a weed cartel, we're fighting those same people. We're going to have, you know, human traffickers. And that's the thing to remember. So when people say, well, you know, weed's legal, I don't use it, or I do, I'm not worried about it for my kids. It sounds kind of like a crazy war story, but there's other stuff going on right now.
Oh, for sure.
With the election, the divisiveness and COVID, I can't really focus on this right now. But I come back to, and this is what I dumped on Congress. I testified in Congress, presented twice in the last year. And the first presentation, I basically said, guys, I don't know of a bigger problem in America that affects every American directly or indirectly that should be much more of a priority within our own borders. A domestic fight to stop this public safety threat these cartels are generating, these transnational criminal organizations, and the environmental destruction.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you know what, though? It's not – and it's a great point you make that, like, people get lost in the idea of, like, oh, it's weed, and culturally we know what that is. All the other things you're talking about, the chemicals they put on it that are deadly, the fact that – and this scares the shit out of me. I don't have kids yet, but like when I was coming up, you know, I bought a joint. It was a joint. It was good sativa. Let's have it.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, oh, could there be fucking fentanyl in that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like getting laced into this stuff. Like it has so many – yeah, exactly.
Answer is yes.
It has so many more layers to it now that the fact that like – especially like you said, it's happening – inside of our own borders. This isn't even the issue where it's like on the border or something.
Right.
This is deep in Northern California and some of these other states you laid out earlier and Jorge talked about obviously a lot. It's like, how were you not making this a priority?
Yeah. And, you know, we talked a little bit before the show about how non-political I like to be. But I think knowledge is power. You know, I trust the American public enough to say just – Don't sugarcoat it. Get it out there. Try to get the message out as honestly as you can. And we're all going to make good judgments on, is this policy or this particular administration working for our best interest? Are they working for American safety? Are they working for security, public safety? And what about environmental purity and water? Because one thing I've noticed through all the political divisiveness we've had all these years, when my team was formed and our team developed and all the people that were part of it, it was a unifier. It was an absolute unifier with hard left, hard right, everybody in the middle.
The people working on it.
Yeah, it was a unifier. Well, I'm talking about the people that would get wind of the issue from growers, you know, pro-cannabis, anti-cannabis, whatever. At the end of the day, I said preservationist, conservationist. I can't tell you how many non-hunting, animal rights groups that still will look at me sideways because the conservation model is, I'm never going to convince them and I shouldn't have to. We sit where we sit, emotionally, rationally, whatever our gut tells us, and that's okay. Agree to disagree, but you don't want to never see a black bear or steelhead trout or deer for your kids and grandkids and a clean, you know, steelhead migrating in clean water and clean water you can drink in your forest. And I never want to see as a hunter an animal die from a nervous central nervous system shutdown, frothing at the mouth, suffocating with their blood, anticoagulating and thinning in their body and dying a slow, painful death within minutes of ingesting this crap. So let's agree this is nasty. And let's agree it's a problem and it affects all of us. And, you know, we get support from both sides. It's one thing that will it'll put all of us in the room and, and people will get off their, you know, defense systems, lower the deflector shields down a little bit and just listen and get pretty sad, get pretty outraged.
When you've testified before Congress in recent years though, how did that come to be? Were you, I mean, there's different ways this happened. People get subpoenaed or whatever, but there's also testimony that happens where certain congressmen are like, "Ooh, I want this expert to come in because our committee talks about this type of issue." What was your intro there to DC?
You know, it was obviously when I retired and I could speak freely, and having this book drop April after I retired the previous December,
back in 2019.
In 2019, when it dropped, and the gloves were off, and I could speak freely on the issue and disparage nobody, but just put it out there. And I could talk about the country because I'm not just California now. I'm dealing with the byproducts everywhere throughout our great nation. And knowing that, you know, 80-90%+ of black market weed from all over the freaking nation that's here, right here where we're at on the Eastern Seaboard, right here in Jersey, New York, Chicago, the Midwest, it's coming from those West Coast cannabis farms.
Right, yeah. You know, some in the drawer out there.
Awesome. But no carbofuran, man. I hope it came from a dispensary, bro. We got to test it because you talked about
– Tommy G tested it a couple weeks ago. It was good.
Hey, Jay, you talk about freaking fentanyl on your joint. Man, carbofuran, just bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Won't kill you quite as fast, but it'll be –
Doesn't look good.
Don't look good. Yeah. Pink, gross, tastes like crap.
Yeah.
But yeah, that got the attention of a lot of people. And then regulations started happening in other states that mimic California, even though I said, don't do that. But they did it. They made it misdemeanors. They saw the taxes, you know, and now they're having not only the Mexican cartel, but the Chinese collusion, which we can dive into a little more.
That's coming.
Yeah. I can't wait. I saw you guys light up.
We're going to get there.
I just love it. I love that we don't hold back, bro.
You're a fire hose. I'm just letting you go, yeah, man. There's so much happening. There's some times there where I try to I'm like, nope, he's going.
Yeah. And I want to caveat an apology on that right now.
No apology. It's fucking great.
When I talk about it with someone that gives a shit and is so knowledgeable like you, I'm back there, you know? And I mean, we're talking, some of these were 15, 20 years ago. Some of them were just experiences that happened 2-3 months ago, say with this team I trained or whatever. And thank you.
I'm glad. I'm definitely not knowledgeable, but I am curious. I just learned about you a few months ago.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, that's crazy. Yeah. I didn't know that, but you know, again, it's I mean, that's the name of your book, Hidden War, because people aren't seeing it.
It's out there in
the woods and you're trying to tell them, but when you get in front of Congress and you're testifying, you know, I tend to get very cynical about Washington DC and kind of how things work. Does some of it feel like the only outcome is going to end up being it's performative because, you know, there's going to be gridlock and people are going to shuffle under a whole bunch of other things?
I honestly wasn't sure because I've heard nothing but the red tape and seen so much negative things happen with the device of Congress and Senate, especially the last couple of administrations. But I can say this. A congressman by the name of Paul Gosar, he's a dentist by trade and a cattleman down the Arizona border. Neat guy. he saw me speak at Safari Club International, the annual conference, which is Safari Club International Hunting. It's a big, big conference down in Nashville a couple years ago. And unlike a lot of congressional aides will sit through my, I do a Hidden War update almost every year at this event and many other events because it's constantly changing and morphing and it affects wildlife. He went to a seminar and usually I get an aide coming to a seminar that'll hit me up like, oh my gosh, you know, this is really, really important. I'm on the southern border or, you know, we're about to look at cannabis in our state and we got to do something different. Maybe we got to consider this. But the congressman and his aide sat through the whole thing. And waited for me to finish and I'm answering questions and we're talking follow up and you're getting a lot of contacts of people that want to either do podcasts or they want you to come teach, whatever the case may be, just spread the message because they're finally alerted. Like now they know, like you didn't know and you went, whoa. And yeah. I didn't know you and all good comes from good stuff, man. And I'm glad we're here again. Yeah. But he said, hey, I want to put a committee together on this bipartisan. And I want you to be one of my experts to come in and tell this story of what I just heard, because all of us on the border dealing with the cartel fentanyl and the destruction of the trafficking and land destruction and, you know, waterways at the border. That's our big forte that everyone is on fire on in my home state, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona. Oh, yeah. He said, Silicon Valley foothills, the rest of the country, the stats you just put up, the experiences, the videos, he goes, I'll put it together. And would you come testify? I said, great guy. I said, Congressman, be my honor. Make it happen. Because at the very least, it'll get on some ears that might not be totally deaf. And in the very most, maybe policy starts to change. At least we start to get the wheel spinning before this next administration does what it's going to do. And, you know, coming in, this was not too close, you know, pretty recent with the election coming up. Mm-hmm. This was within 2 years of what just happened this last week with the change of guard. And people were, there was a lot of, you know, concerns and complaints and divisiveness and morale issues, I think, as a whole to the groups we're dealing with throughout the country. And I didn't hear anything for like 8-9 months. I thought, oh man, you know, it's not going to happen. And then it's last minute I get, you know, an email and a call from that aide for the congressman. And he said, dude, it's only like 2 weeks away, but we're doing this thing and it's going to be, and the name of the hearing was Save Our Parks, Protect Our Borders. I'm like, ooh, interesting. I like the title. That says a lot. And so here's how it's going to go.
That's an interesting, wow.
Yeah, okay. kind of interesting correlation yeah. with what he saw, what he heard, all based on that one presentation.
Save Our Parks, Protect Our Borders?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. Or interchange them however you want. Yeah. But so it worked out where I was one of five panelists and last to go. And you get 5 minutes to talk and you're on a timer and just got everything out I could. I can say this of all the writing and discussing and stuff I've done, getting that down and getting.
I can't see you getting it into 5 minutes.
Dude, I did it. And you know what I had to do? I had to read it verbatim. And time it. And I actually did it in 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
Wow.
420.
Let's go.
That wasn't fucking planned.
Let's go.
That's how it went. So when, you know, I'm reading this over to family members and friends and they're like, okay, that was it. Not too fast, not too slow. Pace nice. Hit hard. Good. I'm like, what's the time? It's 420.
Boom.
I'm like, I didn't plan that,
mic
bro.
Mic drop. Mic drop. There
yeah.
you go.
Now you just hope it goes well. But
do they ask you a bunch of questions afterwards?
They though, can, right? Yeah. And then each delegate gets one question, I believe, how it goes. And then we have a 15-minute dialogue on that. So on my YouTube channel is the edit of that we made to condense testimony and Q&A.
Okay.
And any of that, like Khaleesi, jump on it. It's great. What I really liked about the staff there, not just GOSAR staff, which is, you know, Republican, but then even the Democrats that were on the panel – it was pretty uniform, man. It was pretty unifying the way they dealt with that. And I either got no negative comments, from the left side or some really quizzical follow-up questions and then some really spot on questions that came from some of the coordinators, that I thought really hit it on the head. And it got people thinking about policy changes, but there was an uphill battle with where the administration was at the time on the border. We now know that that's changed.
Yeah, this is interesting though. And I'll tell you why. Because you had really bad policies vis-a-vis the border in the last 4 years. There's just no denying that.
No denying it.
And obviously like part of America speaking with this latest election, that's definitely a piece of it. It's not all of it, but like there's a lot of people who that was a major issue for them and righteously so because it affects downstream like crazy. But what you're talking about here is a hearing I think it was earlier this year, right?
So yeah, it was one last October and one as recently as June. And then there were two others they wanted to have. I could not do it.
But any way you look at it, several months before the election is the last one you do, and the other one's almost a year before the election happens. And this is interesting because, you know, I look at these pendulum swings in society where, like, I fucking hate the two-party system. It's terrible, but it's like this piece of shit that's going to continue to exist, and it's really a uniparty. But it's good when parties lose their way a little bit to get a kick in the ass and bring things back to sanity. Yeah. And I will say, a lot of it felt like too little, too late with Kamala's campaign, and, you know, they're just feeding her like, oh, let's say Second Amendment's good now. And like all this shit we've said the opposite.
I'm going to shoot guns. Okay.
Right. This is like the opposite of what we said for years. But it was almost to me like, okay, well, if the election's over, they're not going to lose.
Yeah.
But if that little ember of like, oh, you know what? Some of this stuff we've been doing is like not common sense at all. That would include things like the border and them suddenly being like, yeah, you know what? We do have to close the border. If that can now be a theme that continues on the left side to where we know that's a theme on the right side right now, and it's a common sense, like this shouldn't even be political kind of thing. If that can be a good outcome of this very divisive time we've lived in and divisive elections, that'll be great. And it's giving me a little hope that it could be, seeing that you were testifying months and months before this and you already saw that there was some, you know, common sense agreement across the aisles. I like to hear that.
Yeah, I went in with an open mind, you know, and I'd never, other than, you know, seeing Washington, D.C. To teach over at Georgetown a couple of years ago, I hadn't been to the Capitol. And now I'm in it and going, okay, what's the vibe going to be? Because I hear the horror stories. And it was pleasantly different.
That's good.
The way it went, which was cool. And then the second hearing, which
– In June
was cartel effects on tribal lands. And I went, wow, this is awesome.
What's that all about?
That's all about our indigenous nations, okay? And what it didn't stem from this, but what had happened was there was maybe it was CBS or NBC, and then it was later maybe Fox covered it as well. But there was this story about she's now retired DA agent Stacey Zinn, and she was actually on the second to last panel. She was in this tribal lands hearing panel, and I testified right after her, and it was about her being sent up to like northern Montana on the Canadian border, as far away as you can get from our southern border in Mexico, and how the Sinaloa cartel and some other factions had worked their way all the way into these really remote tribal lands in my new home state of Montana, you know, like the Cheyenne, the Crow, the Blackfeet, and going into these towns where there's always an addiction issue, you know, in some of these tribal communities, right? And now there's a couple of low-level fentanyl dealers and narcotic dealers and meth dealers, you know, going on. And the cartels from Mexico realizing, hey, wait a minute, man, that's way, way, way in the, you know, in the sticks. And where a fentanyl tablet on the black market from a dirty lab is $5 here in Jersey, we can make $100 a pill on these tribal lands where there is so little enforcement. So you think game wardens have it tough with 250 square miles or whatever. These tribal police are like two BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs officers, that are covering like half a state. It's crazy.
Oh my God.
So they basically infiltrated. They took over the fentanyl trade, and they got tribes addicted, communities decimated.
Oh my
they took
God.
Their trucks. They took their guns. They basically left just a havoc of death, a havoc of destruction on these tribal areas, and taking all that stuff right back to Mexico to fuel the fire for whatever faction was doing it.
I'm sorry to cut you off. I want to connect you with a couple of my guys. You ever hear – I mentioned them a few minutes ago, but you ever hear of Tommy G or Brian Buckingham?
Yeah.
So they've both been on the show. Awesome dudes. I think they're the two best documentarians in the game right now on the internet. But
killer.
Stories like this – like I haven't heard of this. This needs to be covered, but – please continue.
Yeah, I'll check their episodes out and happy to work with anybody you recommend, man. Because, the bigger the team, the better. We're all part of this thin green line now, right?
Yeah.
So that really shocked the consciousness of, like, America, especially fellow Montanians, right? So I got people going, what the heck is this and blah, blah, blah. And ironically, the tribal nation impact was being seen in other parts of the country. But because Montana is considered, like, the last best remote place to go in the lower 48 in America, because it's still so unpopulated, you know, and how different it is from urban environments. And then when people are going to Montana for this pristine reality to live in the woods or retire or get to the big sky, Montana, wait a minute, cartels are taking it. You know, they're putting fentanyl in our communities, and it's not just tribal lands. You know, it's got to be everybody else. So that's what they did. They stemmed up that particular, they made it a priority in Congress because, the tribal nations as a whole were really hitting Congress hard and really hitting the previous administration hard on, like, guys, we don't have the help. You know, we can't tackle this problem alone. We're losing per capita so many more kids and so many more adults to fentanyl deaths than even the rest of America. And I recently heard from my DEA partners that 74,000 Americans are dying annually from fentanyl overdoses from these dirty pills.
That almost seems low.
Yeah, and it almost seems low, and yeah. I'm thinking that's 200 dudes a day.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know? It's fucking crazy.
And how many while we're sitting here talking, brother?
Yeah.
And that blows my mind. And
you have people who are straight up just like they buy fentanyl now.
Yeah.
Like literally, like, it's not laced with anything. No. They're not – they skipped over heroin. It's like, yep. Oh, yeah, I need fentanyl to get high.
Yeah. Whew. Yeah, exactly. And yeah, and the aftermath of that is, I mean,
it's horrible.
Yeah, exponential. But that second hearing was getting into our experiences working with tribal nations, and our MET team right out of the gate, right in Operation Pristine, got that invite letter from some tribes in Northern California and in Central California, said, "Hey, we're overwhelmed with these cartel grows on our tribal lands, and even ones that aren't active that are out there with water diversions and poisons everywhere, and their river, like the Feather River and all the different rivers up in Northern California, they're like, we're getting to a point where so much of our water is being tapped, we're about to turn on our water faucet, and we're just getting drips. We don't even have cooking and bathing water right now. California was in its most massive drought. So that really set a precedent. And then why did that continue? Why was it so exacerbated for them? Well, a couple of BIA cops aren't going to go out and, you know, handle all of this and take down a big cartel yeah. grow safely. And they're trying. They're not doing reclamation. They didn't have the resources. So we went in and we raided grows. But more importantly, we went and cleaned up grows with them. Ones that have been in there for 10 years, still pulling water because the diversion's there. So we did a lot of work with them. And it was kind of a unifying thing where traditionally these tribal nations don't want to work with, you know, domestic police or federal agencies because the history of America and how things have settled out for them.
Yeah.
But to be one of the first agencies invited back, and we're bringing in the air cavalry, not the cavalry. We're bringing in the airships from the military, right?
The airships?
The big Blackhawks.
Oh, yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
And we're pulling out, you know, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 pounds per net of trash off these tribal lands and getting it pristine, and then studying the damages really helped mend fences and, you know, unify those groups with us and with law enforcement in general. And it was, that was definitely a highlight, I think, of my career pre and post-operational, is getting to testify next to some tribal leaders and tell our story that, you know, we absolutely love and respect everything you guys are up against. We feel your pain because we've always been so light as far as personnel, as game wardens covering big, big stretches. And now you guys are even worse case than us. So, and again, that unifying, take away that divisiveness, yeah. You know, so that was really good. Now, I have even more hope now with the recent election. Just a couple of days ago, this is perfect timing. We talked about having this conversation after this election went one way or the other. And I know right now with where the border policy was going before the change and where it's going to go back to, I know how these cartels are viewed currently. I hope there's follow through.
Well, you spent time with Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah.
back in 2016. And how did that come about? Like, how did you?
Yeah, it was kind of random and perfectly timed. One of the trade shows I go to almost every year is the SHOT Show in Vegas. It's the world's largest trade show for military, law enforcement, conservation, weaponry, the tactical community. Big show.
Sounds right up Don Jr.'s alley.
It totally is. And Don Sr. too is a 2A. He's a Second Amendment pro guy, you know. Don Jr.'s a big hunter, avid conservationist. One of Don Jr.'s closest friends was the now deceased, sadly, CEO and founder of Kuyu, what I'm wearing today. And basically outlight, ultralight, outdoor hunting apparel and gear like that. And Jason Hairston, who was that founder, had hunted many times with Don Jr. They were good friends. And Jason was hosting something, for the Trumps that were going to be at SHOT Show in 2016 and wanted to invite about 50 or 60 people from the industry. So he was really, Jason was doing a lot of work with us. We were using his equipment. We were helping him develop a tactical line of clothing to replace the heavy battle gear that our military uses now with better materials. He was working with the DevGrew SEAL Team 6 guys as well on that project a little bit. And he invited me and said I could bring one of my special operator friends, and I brought a SEAL Team 1 buddy of mine that I do a lot of work with, Jared Ogden.
Is this before that election in 2016?
It's right. It's January when he was elected that November. He was just getting ready to start
hitting
the country.
So this is the beginning of 2017?
2016, the start of his campaign.
Oh, wait. I misheard you. So this is when he's still in the primaries?
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
Correct. Yeah, this is – that trade show is like late January. So Jason wanted me there, obviously, because of – this book wasn't out, but Hidden War was. And when Jason met me at Kuyu, when I was introduced to him, he's like, you're a game warden. You're a hunter. You're right here in my backyard in California. And you guys are developing a tactical unit to fight these cartels that I wasn't even fully aware of. He goes, this is really important, because conservation was his thing. That's what that company is based on. And public safety. So I got to go to that with other industry insiders. Don Sr. addressed the whole group of the support he was getting for the campaign. The whole family was there. And specifically, Don Jr. and Jason and I had a conversation where I was able to put a book in Don Jr.'s hands, as well as some documentary videos that we had on DVD at the time from Wild Justice and some of the things we were seeing. And I got to tell a short story about what we were doing. And the look of shock on Don Jr.'s face, he looked at Jason and went, John's a game warden in California, and they're fighting cartels from Mexico, putting the most wretched poisons on cannabis and killing our wildlife. How do I not fucking know about this? And why does my dad not know? And that night we had conversations with Don Sr., and he got wind of it. And I thought, okay, if this if he does get elected, is our little Hidden War going to get represented? I mean, on national policy, there's so many things going on. But right after he did, he put it on Sessions, Jeff Sessions at the time, who was his first AG, and said, look, I'm aware of this thing the cartels are doing on weed, not just this other stuff. And I have, you know, we have solid data and, you know, people we know that are fighting this, like in the Silicon Valley of all places and other parts of the country. I want this to be a priority. I don't want you to look at it as, you know, a U.S. attorney not doing a weed case. Look at the poisons, look at the environmental stuff. And they were funded several million dollars for Operation Forest Watch, where now the U.S. Forest Service, their LEOs that we were working with, Fish and Wildlife, all those federal agencies have this money, and of course we're working with them. And we went to town. We worked a ton of cartel grows. Reclamation was encouraged.
Because you're still in it at this point.
Yeah, still in it. I'm really in the prime.
Yep.
You know, this is like the prime time before I'm going to, you know, retire in late 2018 and hope it continues with great people, and thank heaven it did, and it's improved since.
So you knew you were coming up on retirement.
Yeah, I was.
You were ready.
I was ready. I mean, basically, I worked 28, but with time I had earned, I was had a 30-year career jacket, and you're maxed out at 30 years. You're not. You're going to lose money to continue to work, and more importantly, can you do more for the Thin Green Line outside of work? And I had this book deal pending with a second publisher, with Gun Digest and Recoil, the Caribou book side, knowing that it wasn't going to come out till after I retired, and that I might have stayed on a little longer if there was a real need to, but there were great people behind me. I knew the lieutenant that was going to replace me. I knew the development, all the right people that had the right mindset and were so supportive of what we all did collectively. It wasn't my team. It wasn't anybody's team. I was just very blessed to co-found it, lead it, develop it, be around some of the best people, man, I've ever worked with that are brothers and sisters for life.
But for this point, it seems like the takeaway is Trump got it on this.
Trump got it. He absolutely got it, and he implemented right away. And I heard about it through back channels from the Forest Service. They're like, hey, we're doing this Operation Forest Watch, and we have a bunch of money and time and resources. You guys want to come help? And I went. And then I started to have back communications with – so they got it. They were passionate about it. And
what was that conversation like when you were telling them at the time? Because, I mean, this is before he's president.
Yeah.
He's not even the nominee yet. at that point, but he's still Donald Trump. He's like the Celebrity Apprentice and everything. Like, what was he like? Was it, did it feel more like, oh, this is good for our campaign, let's run with this? Or did it feel like he was interested in the substance of what was happening?
Honestly, it was the substance of what was happening. I don't think the campaign had anything to do with it. And this is what gave me a good vibe on that family is Don Jr., of course, connected instantly because of the connection with Kuyu and the hunting and how outraged he got. But when I started talking to his dad, Don Sr., it was like, yeah, my son, man, I can hardly keep him around. He's out hunting, running around in the woods so much. It's just beautiful. And he goes, and this is unacceptable. This is a travesty. This is horrible.
It's terrible. We're going to stop it right away.
We're going to stop it. We're going to make a huge.
Stop everything.
We're going to stop it huge. Huge, big. You know, it's going to be huge. Huge.
Huge.
And you know what? He followed through like immediately upon election. And so, I mean, biasedly, that being my passion, I'm like, man, what an opportunity. And let's hope it continues. And things with the wall. Let's take the wall, for instance, and border control, right? Right after that, Julian. So not long after that, I retire. And then I'm producing and hosting a film series I do periodically called The Thin Green Line for Recoil TV and my YouTube channel. We're doing the pilot film down on the very unprotected Southwest Texas-Mexico border, the most remote. Like Calendaria is a little town there that's cartel run, and you meet your outfitters, you know, for you're going to go onto this ranch in Texas, and they come in, you know, side by sides and assault rifles. And man, don't get there after dark by the little church under that light. It's a weird little town. I'm like, okay, I'm not even operational. And here I am down here with Marcos, as he's called in the book. One of my close guys, fellow snipers on the team. And we're going down to do this outdad sheep hunt on this 50,000 acre, beautiful Texas ranch. I didn't know there were canyons as big in Texas, like mini Grand Canyons in Texas ever. And, we're talking about the ethics of long range hunting, when you do, when you don't, because we're long range shooters. We're both snipers, precision riflemen. We shoot far, but we shoot close if we get as close to the animal, humane shots if you're going to take an animal for harvest. But at the same time, we're down there, we're watching while we're hunting a pristine sheep in a canyon, 5 miles across the canyon on another part of the ranch, are 15 traffickers coming through with 100-pound bags of processed marijuana with, you know, carbofuran on them, meth, fentanyl, you name it, and trafficking people.
And oh, so, they're trafficking people.
Oh, yeah, dude. They're doing it all. And we found, and it's in the video, and it's not in the book, but in the video on my YouTube channel, The Thin Green Line Film, you'll see some areas where we go in and you actually see these caves on the ranch that were like stash caves or, you know, rest areas as they were trafficking further into America, with the graffiti, the different monikers. Mm-hmm. Looked like just like a cartel grow camp, like in California foothills. And we're hunting one area and coming off a blown stalk on an animal. And all of a sudden a border patrol airship comes flying over, a big helicopter. And the ranchers and the outfitters that are our good friends are like, oh man, we must have tripped a camera. Something's got to be going on, because they have sensors on the ranch, right? And you know, big cameras. He goes, John, if he lands, handle this. And I go, this is perfect. And so I tell Sam, my cinematographer, I go, you got that? He go, oh yeah, I got him coming in. Because basically we tripped a camera and a sensor.
You got to get the shot.
Got to get the shot. But you know what happened was, man, we're on this camera, this long range camera and this sensor, where we're in camo with big long rifles behind us. We don't look like hunters. We look like gunmen.
Yeah.
Because it's a known cartel route. So Border Patrol seeing that, he was the airship, the pilot, Greg, who there's a covert picture, some stuff he's in the book, but he's flying over here, and a bunch of his other officers have just taken down a bunch of smugglers with ATVs on the side of the ranch that we're not, it's so big, we're disconnected. He lands, I go and introduce myself. He goes, oh man, we thought we got the image. And I just left them, and I was coming over to see what you're doing. And he didn't know me personally, but he knew this book. He had heard one podcast, I think, beforehand. I didn't know him. Fantastic pilot from little Alpine County there, you know, of down there on the border. We had a hell of a conversation. Mm. He said, dude, I can't talk about it. You can now. The numbers just coming out of this little part of Texas. And
so this is one of your first, like – unless I'm misunderstanding here, everything you've done is residual effects of what's going on our border, because you're working up in California, you're working out in all the indigenous lands, everything you've talked about today.
Yeah.
But it sounds like this is one of your first times where you're actually at the border itself,
yep,
hearing about where one little trickle in the dam, so to speak, is having all this effect. And you're like, wait, there's 2,000 miles of this too. What the fuck else is going on?
Exactly. Perfectly said. My thing, the reason I wanted to do the first pilot film is it's not just a hunting conservation show. There's 1,000 of those out there and they're great. That's fine. With my concern over what these cartels are doing as it affects conservation and public safety, the two are completely intertwined. So I wanted to get down on the border and this hunt with these outfitters. And these outfitters literally had cartel gunmen come into their camp one night. And the youngest son, who's one of the outfitters, great guy, ended up getting a gun battle in an RV and still has a piece of bullet lodged behind his heart that he took fire when these
guys. Behind his heart.
Yeah. And that piece will always be there. They
That'll
can't remove
it.
Yeah. The love, the support.
Got a little bullet behind my heart.
A little bullet by my heart.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm good.
Touch you right there.
Yeah. Don't. Oh, easy. No, not that side.
Well, he lived. He lived.
No, he did. He's, yeah, yeah. He's married, got just beautiful family. But the thing about it that blew my mind was, okay, I've been fighting with my team and we've been fighting the remnants and the, you know, basically the effects of what's going on or not going on the border. And now I want to see it for the first time. And I had tons of invites, but operationally, I'm not going to leave California. We had our hands full. This is right after. So I'm down there with those guys doing this hunt, making contacts, sharing information of what we're dealing with, you know, keeping everybody a little more in the loop. And I saw it firsthand. I saw the most pristine part of Texas on this ranch being absolutely garbaged and decimated and exploited by cartel traffickers, not just weed, not just fentanyl, not just meth, but trafficking as well, as we were hunting one of the most pristine animals in the most pristine states. Complete contradiction, yeah, but showing how much it was an effect there. That part of the Rio Grande River that separated,
mm-hmm,
it was a creek. It wasn't even a river. The parts of it where Jorge talked about getting in with them and they were drowning once a,
yeah,
day, that's horrible. And that's a lot of the Rio Grande. But the reason this place is so sensitive is
because it's small here.
It's small. It's February. We're doing this hunt and you could wade across it like the little creek I grew up on or in my backyard in Montana. So trafficking was easy. Border Patrol was fully supported at that time under the new administration. All the wall materials, the metal and stuff that was laid out to get ready to be built was all there.
But it's not up yet.
Oh, it got taken away because, yeah, when the, you know, administration shifted, when we had that switch in 2020, right after we made this film, now it just got wide open. And those guys down there were just those border agents.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk to anyone who's on the border, they were voting one way in,
yeah,
this previous election. And I understand that because that's their main issue. And the previous administration was very bad on it. The thing I always wonder though, and,
yeah,
I'd love your thoughts on this.
Yeah,
my,
for sure.
My little tinfoil brain gets tingling sometimes.
Got a thought.
It's like, you know, you see how far back intelligence is intertwined with things that go on south of the border. And I don't know what all that is. Some of that I'm sure, yeah, I could understand, though, as messy as it might get.
Yeah.
I wonder if sometimes it spills over, though, in ways that maybe,
yes,
they weren't planning for that are huge mistakes on their part, that then get stuck in the tit-for-tat game of Washington, D.C. Do you think there's some of that that could occur versus it just being like, oh, the Democrats just want an open border?
I do. I think you're right. I think it's, yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, I think there's – I think we're just short-sighted, man.
Yes.
I think there was one objective and they didn't think of, you know, realistically the escalation of what it would catalyze. I mean, the numbers – and the environmental destruction, the public safety problems we've had throughout the entire country since that border policy completely,
yeah,
changed. I don't want to believe, forget politics. I don't want to believe that anybody could be that intentionally destructive from a humanitarian standpoint, an environmental standpoint, public safety standpoint. I don't think people anticipated, regardless of party, what was going to be the fallout,
yeah,
for the objective of just getting a lot of people here.
Well, I also think I'll bet it's actually kind of similar in Washington, D.C. Sadly, there's no excuse for this. But when I talk to people who aren't political or are liberal,
yeah,
or haven't paid attention to the border or whatever, and I tell them some of the things that I know from my guys who have been on this show on camera and off camera and everything, and then some of the other people I've gotten to know who are down there, you know, they're shocked. And they're like, what?
Yeah.
You know, because it's a humanitarian crisis and everything. And I feel like, you know, you just had Harris, who was the border czar in big air quotes there.
Yeah.
And she hadn't even been to the fucking border.
She hadn't been there.
Right? I think she went finally when she was actually campaigning. But, like, if she had just gone as vice president of the United States, she'd have access to fucking everything and just seen it in 2021 or something. Like, you can't tell me that there wouldn't have been a wake-up moment there where it's like, oh, my God, like, all right, we're so worried about, you know, being friendly to everyone that we're actually allowing something to occur that's a total crisis. And let's not lose the 500-pound elephant in the room here. It's important to say this.
Yeah.
You know, there's an aspect of this Trump derangement syndrome thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are a lot of negatives about Trump. There are also things, though, that you have to admit he's right about. And I'll tell you, I had – after he won the election, I was looking through some of the old videos from 2015, 2016 when he would go on the late-night shows like Jimmy Fallon, Stephen Colbert, stuff that looks like it's out of the Twilight Zone now.
Yeah, you're like, whoa.
And like, you know, he talks like Trump. He's like, listen, we're going to build a border. We're going to build a wall. Mexico's going to pay for it. Like he was still like consummate like Trump, and they'd be like – you sure about that? Yes, I'm sure. You listen to the takes, remove some of the simplicity of it. Objectively, he was right.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing I couldn't – even if he was saying it like a third grader, which actually should be refreshing to a lot of people.
Yeah.
What he was saying made complete sense, and the people who then went against that because they hated him so much.
Yeah.
If you run the tape on things that like Obama was saying in 2013, 2014, he was spot on.
Yeah.
But then the difference was this guy with weird hair from New York who was a billionaire who decided that, you know, Obama was born in Kenya. They were so offended by that. And I get that. You know, like I get that, that they're like, all right, whatever he says bad, we do opposite. And now they dug themselves into this corner where they're missing the fucking plot, the whole plot of what's happening down there.
Yeah. You just nailed it on the head again. This got to where nobody's perfect. You got to read through the rhetoric, but I look at it this way. Actions, policy, implementation. What did those actions lead to? Did they have a dent? Were they going in the right direction? And you just said it best, brother. Does it make sense? Yeah, it does. Nobody ever said, and people, well, you think that's going to solve the problem, putting up this expensive wall? I go, no, it's not going to solve the problem. But I know from being a law enforcement officer dealing with these guys, and I know how border security is run. I know how the old process was. I'm familiar with it. I've been on the border. I have a lot of friends in those federal agencies and the state agency on the Texas border and talk about it. It's not a stop. It's a stopgap.
Yeah.
You know, it goes so far beyond a wall, but the wall isn't only a stopgap physically. It says a little something, I think, to the American people that, hey, guys, it's not about keeping people out. This is a freaking melting pot. I'm all for immigration. Yes. That's why we're here, man. We, greatest country on the planet, we are not one way or the other. Everybody's welcome if they're here for the right reasons, chasing that dream. They don't want to hurt people. I'm good with that. But this is a symbol, I think, with this wall, that we care about protecting our country. We care about protecting you as an individual citizen. We care about protecting the wildlife you like. We care about protecting, you know, your children from fentanyl or abduction or whatever. Is the wall going to solve all that? No, but it does make sense.
And it's start.
It's a good start. And along with education and awareness and all the other stuff that isn't just throw a bunch of force at it, throw a bunch of resources like law enforcement. Yeah, we need more of that. Yeah, there's talk about really ramping up Border Patrol to do what they were doing before. It's going to have to happen. We're going to feel the effects of what has come across this border. I think conservative estimates a decade to sort it out. But I think you're right. Sorry to interrupt just this one thing.
No, you're good. You're good.
So many people that see the benefits of the policy but hated that man so much.
Right.
They voted with emotion. And some of my closest friends voted with emotion that I respect and love forever. And I will never judge. I will sit with any supporter of the other side because you know what? We've lost every sense of what this country's about if we start slinging mud at that level, and that's what it's become.
Yeah.
And it's got to stop.
I'm glad to hear you say that too, because the divisiveness really bothers me. Like I said earlier, the shit moves in pendulums in society.
It does.
It's how it goes. One party loses their way at some point, and for the better, shit gets a little reset. And hopefully that's kind of where we're at right now. But, you know, if there's one thing that I think Trump did a very bad job of when he was first coming up and probably along the way in the maybe you could call it like the rhetoric of this.
Yeah.
It's the emphasis. Like, I feel like he never did a great job emphasizing the fact that, hey, our actual immigration system itself of how you legally immigrate is also broken.
Yeah.
And we need to improve that because, and I know he said this before, he just doesn't highlight this enough.
Yeah.
We want great people coming in here. We like everyone, I don't know about you, but the two of us, like, I don't even go three generations back in this country, right?
I don't.
We
come from France and all other places.
There you go.
Yeah, we're not native to this nation.
So that is what our country's built mm-hmm. on. And we want that to continue.
Amen.
But when you have fucking 2 million people coming across the border in a month, a year, whatever it is, like a crazy number of people.
Right.
And you can't vet any of them. All it takes is 10 of those people to be terrorists and the whole system's ruined.
10 dirty bombs,
yep.
10 malls, 10 schools, 10 sporting arena events, whatever. That's where one thing I do like about the election winning speech, it happened late that night. I caught just a little bit of it on the night of the election a couple nights ago was just that, man. The safety aspect of it, you know, no, we don't have accountability of who these people are. We don't know what they're going to do or not going to do. And we know that how many hundreds on the terrorist watch list were interdicted or processed or seen through. Jorge talked about it. I had that same figure. He and I were talking about that way back when we did the last documentary. It was going on then, you know, 2 years ago. But that has to be an emphasis. But I did hear him say, finally, and you're right, man, it did not get emphasized enough because the key isn't so much, don't just focus on this, you know, hidden evil, the boogeyman that's coming across. Let's talk about the good part of immigration of the country, right?
Well, he did that in that first speech in 2015. He goes, they're murderers.
Yeah.
And some, I assume, a good – he basically was like – what was John Stewart's line? He's like – he basically said no disrespect to an entire fucking country. Yeah. It's like, dude, you gotta – I know you're funny, but
focus that phrase. Yeah, I think the good thing is he said we want to encourage people coming.
Yeah.
We want to encourage immigration. We got to get it right. And he did address that, thankfully – indirectly, but he was referring to just what you said, immigration policy. And not just talking about it, but let's do like you did at Forest Watch, man. Let's kick that into gear like now. I know border and security and cartel threats. Yeah, please, please, please treat this as a domestic priority. Yeah. I know we don't need more proxy wars. We're putting all those billions, man, over in the Ukraine right now. And I'm going, give us a quarter of that. Give us a quarter of it.
Yeah.
I'll bet we'll dominate and, you know, solve this.
Zelensky's like, no.
No, he's no. But I'm
don't
like,
give us money.
But I'm like, dude, you're fighting over there and I got kids dying of fentanyl, man. And I got weed that's killing my fish and it just needs to frickin' stop. And we need resources to do that. And not just a ton of law enforcement and conservation, everybody, but educating kids what to look out for, how to deal with the potential trafficking situation, how to stay connected, not to touch the right pill. You know, what do we give our teenagers, right? Test kits? If they get a bad pill for a pain relief? I mean, there've been all kinds of little discussions, but anyway, those things need to get addressed. And, I hope the immigration policy is right up there with it. Cause I think we just, and it really was the last administration's time period that I think catalyzed immigration to be a priority now.
Because
we're just going to go back to the same old semi-broken system with a little bit of help on the border protection aspect. But to your point, I think you're 100%.
That's the thing where because I like to have hope. I've always said this. Whoever wins the election and be president, then now the president of my country, and I'm fucking rooting for him.
Yeah.
Now, my job, does that not mean that when they do a terrible job, I'm not going
to
criticize them? Of course I
have to.
But I am rooting for them because they're in charge of my country, and we're at this point now where people don't do that, and that kind of blows my mind. So I am hoping Donald Trump does as good a job as he could possibly do. And maybe this is wishful thinking, but a part of me has been reflecting on like him getting back in, and it is an incredible political comeback for sure. But like He was voted out of office after, you know, you could point to things in the first 3 years of his administration that were solid, including border policy, for sure, objectively speaking.
Yeah.
And then he had a disastrous 2020 year, fucked up a lot of things.
Yeah.
People voted him out. And there's a part of me that says, you know, hopefully like 4 years away for him to see this now from the outside, having been there, fucked up a lot of things because he had never been in government before and stuff like that.
That's the key point. He hadn't been in Washington, man.
Yeah.
It wasn't running a Fortune 500 company, you know, that's a perfect point.
So maybe now there will be a little bit more of a, I don't know if this is possible with him, but a little bit more of like a zen about some stuff.
Hope
like,
so.
Like you've stepped back. You've seen it from the outside. You can assess what you did wrong. He did. He was a little bit reflective in that Rogan sit down. He did. That surprised me.
I was wondering. Yeah, when I finally laid into that, I made sure on a long drive back home to Montana that I listened to it then,
right?
A couple days after, because I knew Joe was having him on, and I'm like, okay, well, I want to really, because if you're ever going to get the real vibe of where he's coming from, Joe would be the guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I
did
I think,
a great job. That's why he's the GOAT.
I really think Joe structured it correctly. I like that he had Vance on. I like that he invited Harris, you know, to go on and just to talk about, not get political. But I did. I saw some hope of direction. You know,
sure.
but a little zen. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, talking
he's
about
still what, Trump. He's still Trump.
You're always going to have that. Yeah. Built this, did that. Look at this. Look at me. You know, and all that.
But like talking about the people he hired and mistakes he made.
Yeah.
Like this is a guy who would never admit a fucking mistake
before.
And I heard that, and I could tell it was like poison coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
But the fact that he was doing it a little bit, it's like, all right, maybe he's just old enough now that like he's a little bit reflective. Like just
we can hope.
Just a little bit. That'd be cool.
Yeah. And the other thing I noticed, you know, he can do this one term and this is one term. So
right.
He could, you know, breathe a little bit and make the best dent you can.
Yeah.
I kind of had that when I keep coming back to one of my mentors, Mike Carey, on the chief of our agency that came back reluctantly. He was going to retire, but he had to, we said, everybody wanted him. He was that guy, just objective, good career history, very smart, and not afraid to be progressive. Where progressive, out of the box, a little bit scary thinking would be a thing. And he knew he was only going to be there 2 years. So, you know, the gloves are kind of off. You don't have to prove yourself. You're here. You know, you got the highest job in our agency for law enforcement. Now we're looking at the new president of the United States. And there was a little bit of zen coming out. I think that I saw a little bit in the humor and a little bit in the Rogan podcast. I just hope it continues.
I hope so.
And so far with the things he's mentioned continuously, a good handful of things that I think we all share in this room should be a national priority are going to get addressed.
For sure.
Really changed, which is cool.
Real quick, John, I have to go to the bathroom. But
so do I.
Great timing. But when we come back, we're going to talk all about the Chinese Sinaloa connection and stuff like that and some of the things you've seen on the border and how that's spilling over into California, which is how you got involved, as you mentioned, with our mutual friends Jorge and Sognik over there.
Yep.
It's like some of that shit's crazy. So we'll do that. And I think we're also going to do a Patreon episode too. So
let's do it.
We'll be right back.
All right. Yeah.
But anyway, so we're back on now. And we said did that thing. Yeah, just slide that right on. There you go. Beautiful. So we're back on. We're going to get into some of the Chinese stuff.
Oh yeah.
Because I've had Nick Shirley in here. I think I mentioned that earlier, as well as Jorge talk about this extensively. Rocco talked about it a little bit, but Nick Shirley, who's a YouTuber covering the border and migrant crisis primarily. Yeah. He was able to get a hold of a document. He showed it here. It was in episode 214.
Nice.
I want to say that was like an hour and 45 minutes into that one or something, but people can go check it. He recovered a document that from one of the Chinese immigrants who, you know, they look different than a lot of the rest of the immigrants who are desperately more trying to come here. These are like people that look like they're coming straight out of the suburbs of China.
Yeah.
And they have this document in Chinese that basically explains from leaving China all the way to final destination in bumblefuck America, down to the most specifics of every legality they're going to run into, part of the process, how to get around our system, how to use DHS to their advantage, like fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And all I can think is like, there's got to be an espionage aspect to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I know where you're going with that. And I remember when I first started to see the reports and then talked to Jorge about this specifically, when all of these military age Chinese males with super clean passports and great clothes and they just weren't coming through the normal channels. I figured it had to be something going on with a different cartel faction. And then when it came out that they were paying much more, so they had it all secure to go where they're going to go. Excuse me. But it was lining up and made sense with what we were seeing in Northern California and what the other states are starting to see. Jorge Sognik and I saw this up in Siskiyou County. Our Fish and Wildlife Cannabis Enforcement Program, my MET buddies, were seeing this starting – I mean, 2017, it actually kind of started before the border crisis. Mm-hmm. Chinese kind of coming in and showing a presence, not a dominating presence, but a presence in the cartel weed trade. Like, why is an organized Chinese group in the Hmongs coming in from Minnesota, Wisconsin, that area, and coming out? And then we come to find out that with the fentanyl crisis and all those precursor chemicals coming from China, which – under some bylaws and some documents I've seen from DEA friends, they're not even, you know, supposed to use back in the mainland. Yeah. But they export them here, obviously, and we know Sinaloa, Jalisco New Generation, any of those cartel groups or other derivatives are getting those precursors from the Chinese. And what was a real shocker to me, about a year ago, I got wind of the money laundering collaboration between Mexican cartels and Chinese crime groups for laundering money in America, just in plain sight. And the Chinese saying, basically, listen, we want to get into the weed trade because it's a cash business. We want to build cash untraceable reserves and have a cash surplus. And
I wonder what that's for.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah.
Yeah, what, especially domestically.
Yeah, I'm sure, right? They're just investing it in the markets, getting S&P returns, obviously planning for the future.
Planning for the future, planning, yeah, making sure their kids are getting into good schools.
That's right.
You know, Harvard and Stanford.
That's
you
right.
You know? But yeah, when that was all going on, I'm like, okay, so explain to me how this is kind of working. And the Chinese come in and say, hey, we like the weed trade because of the cash money, obviously. And you guys are still in it, but you're good at fentanyl. Trafficking is going both ways. You do fentanyl like nobody's business, man. So let's get a collaboration going here. And I didn't realize at the time, 5-6% of everything the cartels make south of the border, 5-6% of all of their cash profits from all the crimes they're doing goes to money laundering. They got to pay that much. The Chinese, they said, we'll launder your money for 4% if you give us a weed trade, and we'll work some deals out with the precursor chemicals. And then it became 3% as they started to get more comfortable with each other. Now it's down to like zero. I'm hearing they're paying no money,
zero
money to China to launder their money domestically.
What's the catch?
The catch is free fentanyl, you know, precursors. They can exchange, you know, barter it, and also trafficking people in grows, whether they're Mexican individuals or even Chinese working together in the weed trade. But a lot more dominance from the Chinese and the Asian cartel groups now. We're seeing running the weed trade, at least in California, as well as Maine seeing it, Michigan seeing it, and the other states I've worked with out there. So we know they're working together, and we know it's a long-term – it's been a long-term relationship now. It's been going on for many, many years. But it's all been happening domestically here, and it makes sense now when you talk about all of these thousands of military-age males looking very clean, like you said, and not your "I'm just going for broke to get to America" appearance comes across. Pretty mind-blowing, but it's a fairly new trend. And something actually that in October, a year ago October, in that testimony, I dropped that on Congress related to environmental crime, because right then we were seeing not only the weed trade for fentanyl and the money laundering connection between those two entities, but we were starting to see new chemicals and new poisons in these grow houses and on these grow sites. And it wasn't carbofuran or metaphos smuggled up from Tijuana. It was actually poison containers with Chinese language on them. And there's, I think, 6 or 7 of them. One's an antifungal. They're, you know, anticoagulant nerve agents. Nasty. At least as nasty as those, the other poisons we've talked about that I've highlighted in the book. But when Jorge Sognik and I were up on raids on that last day that I was with them to kind of culminate a week of everything in Siskiyou County, we went in with Siskiyou County Sheriff's Department, their MET team. Guys, obviously, I had worked with operationally, but hadn't seen them for many years because I've been in the outreach game and retired. Now I'm back in thinking, oh, yeah, it's going to be bad. I know how bad it is. dude.
Get the boys back together.
Get the boys back together. And when I found out who we were working with, I said, Jorge, this is going to be epic. You've got to meet these guys. These guys are freaking fantastic.
Sognik's shitting himself.
Sognik is like, you know, he's like the...
I did not come to America for this.
Sognik is like the unflappable, like, you never... Are we freaking him out yet? Sognik, are you good with this? And he's just like... Right on there filming. Like, dude, are
no,
you?
No, I got the shot. You're good.
Are you concerned or not? He's like, we're not shot yet. You know, we haven't been bit by one of these rabid, you know, cartel guard dogs that they're abandoning and are ending up abused. That's not even a joke. But no, man, we got up there and I got to see some of the old guys and that was 3.5-4 years after I retired.
Yeah.
And Siskiyou County had blown up exponentially since I was up there. Now, granted, I'm hearing stories from my Met buddies of how bad it is, but it's just hoop house after hoop house after hoop house there. You know,
hoop house?
Hoop house is like that visqueen lined greenhouse that looks like those little pictures you pulled up on Jorge's episode of like the Amazon, the Bezos kind of layout of complexes.
You really studied that episode. I'm impressed. Well, thank you.
Yeah, no, I did. I watched it and had to see the connection. And on top of that, a lot of that same stuff and those photos had come into me from sources at the federal level that are literally in my PowerPoint. And when I teach and, put the stuff out to LE groups or civilian groups where it's appropriate. But yeah, it was 10,000 to 15,000 grow houses up there and none of them were very remotely in the woods. I mean, they're all in the woods, but it's not like going 8 miles into the backcountry where you're on a pristine creek, say in Yosemite National Park now. Now they're down a dirt road and they're stacked on top of each other. And here's where the environmental impacts, to make analogies that our listeners will understand, how exponentially worse they are, as bad as it was in those open field forests. So you've got this big, you know, visqueen lined capped greenhouse that might have 1,000 to 4,000 or 5,000 plants. It's not open air. It's got this massive tarp on it. So it's a contained environment, right? Like kind of pressurized until you ventilate it, like kind of in a vacuum. And we're finding these 55-gallon drums of unnamed chemicals. 55-gallon drums.
55-gallon drums.
Yeah, two or three of them in every complex. And then we're finding these little rooms where there's these Tyvek kind of hazmat suits with those N95, you know, fitted masks that you rebreathe through. We have to wear that stuff now to go into some grow sites. When I was leaving agency, we had so much issues with poison exposure and our dogs through the paws that we had to get fitted for all this stuff. And if that poison had been put on an outdoor, say, cartel grow, Mexican grow, and we can see the white droppings on the plants and it oozing off, and there's pictures again so everybody can reference it in color in hidden war. That means it's been applied to the plant within the last 24 hours or so, and we can't even touch it with PP protective gear. It's too hot.
And this is only miles from like regular old California civilization.
Absolutely. Yeah, these are just rural little towns and
wow.
Yeah, and then this stuff, when it dries invisible. So all that really potent black market weed that is all over the net, you know, all over the marketplace where we're sitting right now here in Jersey, you can't tell it's on there. It doesn't kill anybody instantly, but you're slowly putting nerve agents and toxics into your body, whether it's an edible, whether you're smoking it, whatever the case may be. Potent good weed, all black market. So we started to see these poisons, and I'm like, this is a new game. You know, and because it's encapsulated in these buildings, exposure to officers or growers or anybody, people in the neighborhood, if the winds were going down, you know, downhill, and you got community members up in Siskiyou County that are like the American dream, right? World War II veteran couples settle up, get a little cattle ranch, they're raising cattle. They've got Mount Shasta, the beautiful, pristine looking Glacier Peak right in the distance, very remote on the Oregon border, beautiful county. And now it's thousands and thousands and thousands of organized crime growers, mostly Asian now, between the Chinese and the Hmong, a little bit of Hispanic still with the Mexican cartels.
You mentioned it a minute ago, but just for people who didn't see the Jorge episode, can you just explain exactly who the Hmong are?
Yeah, the Hmong are a group of – they're from Southeast Asia. They're a nomadic group of Asians that live primarily in America. Where these guys are coming from is like Minnesota, Wisconsin, and they have been – brought out because of the organized crime and the profit ability with all this cannabis out in California and other states. They've been brought out to grow it and or to be put there with a guarantee of money, and some of them aren't getting paid. And
yeah, they're basically enslaved.
Yeah, they're basically enslaved, or, you know, if they're not locked up every night, which in some cases they are, we're finding out, they're kind of pressured and extorted a little bit to where they're waiting for money that they're never going to get. They can't really leave. Pretty heinous. And we saw that firsthand in Siskiyou, and we see it all the time. It's happening in Shasta. It's happening in other parts of the country too.
I got to ask what is a really Captain Obvious question here, but obviously doesn't have a Captain Obvious answer. You know, I'm hearing you all day talk about these sites that exist, as I just said a couple minutes ago, just miles from regular old civilization, mm-hmm. here deep within inside our own borders.
Yeah.
And you're telling me you got to dress like you're about to fucking invade World War II Japan just to go to some of these places in our own country.
True story, yeah.
We know where a lot of them are. Why is a phone call not made to, like, the White House today to send 12 agencies in there, like a military unit? You're just going into the woods. There's hardly anyone out there. You warn some of the civilians that are out there and just take it all down. I don't understand why we can't just throw like $4 or $5 billion at this and one day, boom, be done with it.
Yeah, and that's actually that's actually a good solution. And, you know, do kind of a roving task force. I talked about this with Mike Ritland. I know you had my brother Mike on the show.
Great guy.
Yeah, and he asked the same question after going through the book. He was, I think, the first studio podcast I'd ever done was Mike's podcast.
Mike to this day is one of the most underrated podcasts in America.
Oh, he's the best.
He's so good.
Yeah.
So good, man.
He's amazing. Yeah. I mean, and going length, diving in deep, mm-hmm. spending 3-4 hours if you need to. We had, I think, a 4-hour conversation.
Yeah.
And
he asked some of the best questions of anyone on the internet.
Yeah.
Really good.
And really dissecting it, kind of like we're doing now. You're going down the rabbit hole, places a lot of people don't go, and we need to go there. But essentially, yeah, that was, that is, the only solution we can do to make a dent is to put a massive force on it, whether it's combined allied agency, retired military. Mike and I talked at the end of the podcast. He goes, hey, I'd come out of retirement, and if I could be deputized, I'd be a dog handler, do whatever, get assets to fly us and go as a strike team wherever we need to go. You met guys, some retired SEALs. You know, we have, you know, SEAL team veterans and military guys from SF and stuff on the team now.
They would mop the floor with these fucking guys.
We absolutely would. But it would have to be considered, A, that national priority and be illuminated as such, which it never quite has yet, to put us on, like, we're going to put all this money, say, in a Ukraine war, or we're going to go do a proxy war. We haven't addressed it to that level.
When they'll give you $750 to do it.
Yeah. You got it. Well, and I mean, on that front, that's a true point. But let's look at terrorism in the world and how we deal with it, right? Mm-hmm. This war on terror. How do the cartels, when you define terrorism, do the cartels qualify as terrorist organizations? If you look at the definition,
that's a really good question.
And if you dissect it, you could pull up the definition of terrorism right now, and you could look at the general definition, the military definition. There's a bunch of different definitions. And I think of Taylor Sheridan, what a producer, director.
Amazing. Everything he does.
Best stuff just reeks. Yeah, it reeks of quality. And in Sicario and Sicario 2, when he talks about these cartels are now defined as a terrorist organization, so now we're going to fight them as such, right, within those rules of engagement. And I think when you look at the fact that there's such a public safety threat, there's definitely a political impact because you're changing communities. You're running mm-hmm. out Americans and ranchers and farmers and veterans, literally leaving a county like Siskiyou, and now it is run by basically a foreign entity, destroying the environment, making money off poisonous cannabis, as one example, and human trafficking, anything else that goes in there. Killing anyone that gets in their way if they get too high up. And that really comes into, you know, adjusting and manipulating policy by fear, right, by terror, and having that impact on people to change their lives and to change how we handle government in that area. And so I think it does qualify.
Yeah, we have the definition right up here. Alessi pulled it up. It's terrorism. The main definition that comes up first on Google is the unlawful use of violence and intimidation, especially against civilians in the pursuit of political aims. So
if it's,
I would say violence and intimidation, yep, right alone, the Hmongs fit that right away because, yep, they're often enslaved here against their will, as it turns out. the people that they're killing along the way. Who, I mean, were you there when Sognik and Jorge got in that car chase?
No, that was the first documentary they did before I met him.
Got it.
And then once I met Jorge and we got connected, we had a sidebar meeting with Sognik and had lunch, and then we were off to the races to go to Siskiyou County.
Right.
And that's a crazy story, what he saw down there.
Oh, it's insane.
Yeah.
But right there, you know, they would have killed like 1.5 civilians if they got them. And, you know, I say it's a good question, because the way we're trained to think about terrorism is like, you know, people who just go blow up a building randomly. But what these guys are doing, I mean, if you see six people hanging outside Cabo or something, that's kind of terrorism, you know? And when they're doing it here, they're not even coming from their own country of origin. They're coming here and attacking some of our people or whatever. I would agree. It probably should be characterized that way.
Yeah. No, I think you're right on. And I think about those civilians. Jorge talked about it. We saw it firsthand. Our MET unit's been dealing with reports of people in these rural areas, wonderful Americans, just trying to survive. And now their water is gone, and they're being told through intimidation from both factions, cartels, Chinese or Hmong or Mexican cartels, your water is going to disappear. Don't make an issue of it, and you're probably going to be okay to stay. Or make an issue of it. This is going to happen. And they're intimidating and plate carriers, and they've got guns because they know law enforcement response is slim to nil. 2-3 hours away, same type of thing we talked about, the game warden, you know, conundrum. And so, yeah, I do think it does fit the definition, and it affects us more directly as individuals and citizens of America than I think even some of these foreign threats. So I would – and this did come up shortly after the election results. I can't remember where I saw the clip, but something about where our new administration is going to define these cartels. Once on, you know, the border's one issue, but actively working in America and how we're going to handle it. And I think there might be some radical changes.
Yeah, we got to be careful with that though, too. Cause like one of the things that did really concern me last time Trump was in was he was, there were strong reports that he was like, why don't we just drop a bomb on Mexico or whatever? And that's a very bad, like, he needs to get rid of those thoughts. That stuff's a very bad idea. I understand this is a huge threat. We got to figure out how to fix it, but there are ways, like, there's multiple fronts on which said war is fought, and it actually starts with the stuff that's on our own side before them. You know what I mean? Like, obviously their government is infested. It's not too great.
Right.
But we can fix things here before they have to internally fix some things there. We cannot be the world's police and spreader of democracy because, you know, frankly, we're very bad at that.
Yeah, you're 100%. And no, it needs to be a domestic fight. Deal with what's in our borders first. Take the gloves off. And it's not just a harder law enforcement response. It's just not throwing, you know, a more aggressive stance with force through governmental law enforcement groups, whoever they happen to be. It's everything we talked a little bit about before, even outside of recording. It's educating our kids on the threats, being very honest about it, understanding what a human trafficking thing could look like, where you could be abducted, educating on fentanyl at the youngest age, and just letting everybody know publicly. And it's not a good message you want to give in school, but it was the same thing, you know, don't get in a car with strangers. And we all went through that grade school training of different things to look for. Well, now it's a much bigger issue. Because this isn't just happening from our own people. This is a foreign entity that multi-billion dollar enterprise, and they are basically, you know, having a field day at our expense. So I agree. Handle what we can internally, domestically, but we got to handle it more severely.
Oh, yeah.
And more comprehensively. And as far as the politics on the Mexico side, that's been a hot and cold thing without the resources down there. And I absolutely love Mexico as a country. I love the people down there. I've been on a Baja off-road UTV racer for a lot of years. Side-by-side, racing Baja on quads, motorcycles.
That sounds fucking awesome.
It is, yeah.
The last time I drove a quad, I was 9 years old, and I crashed into my friend's birthday cake at his party. So, yeah, I got to get back to that. But they sound awesome.
No, it's great. The little side story. In 06, we raced the Baja 500 for the first time down there. I was on a quad, my partner on a motorcycle, an Ironman team to try to do them solo. And in 2010 and 2013, we did that. There's an orphanage down there we support, good kids doing
so
good
cool
things. Yeah. El Oasis out of Ensenada, these amazing children, brother. They're like homeless and abandoned, left on the streets of Ensenada, you know, mom or dad, addicts, whatever, problems. And they get brought into this facility and all outside forces, sources give them a good school. They've got den mothers. They've got good, structure, farming operation going on, great education, about 60, 70 kids cycle through Excellent. There and from, you know, just above infancy to all the way. I've seen some of them graduate high school and go to college.
That's so rewarding.
Yeah.
So
and,
cool.
And I think going down there to have fun, we wanted to race, but we also wanted to, you know, race for a cause, and that was it. And we got a lot of support when we're racing. People throw money at it. They support the deal. But yeah, Baja is a magical part of Mexico. And from the off-road racing, being in the spirit of the really wild, wild, Baja's it. And in 2013, I successfully soloed the whole Baja 500 on a quad by myself with no relay riders, which was the first to ever be done. I had a lot of support and help, but when I got to that finish line that night, because of that solo effort, I can't tell you how much more money and more support was thrown to El Oasis based on people knowing I was going to try to Ironman it. And the odds are against you, not necessarily because of your endurance, because Baja is just a kick-ass hard course.
Right.
And 50% of every class of vehicles that go in there approximately won't even make it to the finish line because they'll break. And I can't go there anymore, obviously, with the work I do. And it's heartbreaking. But the whole point of my long-winded story there is great, great culture. And you get on Southern Baja, and you get into those farm countries and those orchards and the citrus, and you see these beautiful people. And they're dealing with the same threats.
Yeah, it's not their fault.
Exponentially, yeah. They're dealing with the cartels running their units, exactly. Running their towns, and they don't have the resources to fight that. We've seen it go up and down. We've seen the level of corruption. That has to be addressed with collaborative efforts with Mexico, I think, from this current administration. We're not going to go down there and just start ripping and tearing, but I agree, start here. But keep in mind what's going on down
Absolutely.
There. And from a humanitarian side,
yes.
I really want to see the Mexican public in this consideration on however we address this. And maybe we'll get that lucky.
Yeah.
And we'll have some leadership down there to help with that.
To your point, they live under an iron fist.
Completely.
And that's why, like, you know, the majority of the people who are trying to come here are perfectly fine. It's the ones who slip through because we have no system where it's a huge problem.
Right.
Right. But I fully understand why those people are trying to leave Mexico or some of these other countries where they're torn apart. And so another way to help fix this is when you have, you know, resources and ability to share back and forth so the countries themselves can also clean themselves up and can be much more livable places in certain spots. And, you know, it keeps coming back to some of the extracurriculars with other countries who are taking advantage of this. And we've been talking about China and everything, but like, you ever read this book, Fentanyl Inc., by Ben Westhoff?
I need to read it. I've heard about it from you. I've heard you mention it on another show, and a couple other sources have said I've got to read it. I'm diving in.
Yeah, I think I got to have him in because I've brought him up on the show probably about 10, 12 times
before. Yeah,
he'd
be a great guest. Yeah.
Joe Rogan did a podcast with him in 2019, and this guy – this was like the first alarm bell for me at what an issue we are. And I'll explain where I'm going with this. But he was like a culture reporter, wrote on like music and shit. And so he gets assigned this feature story on something in the music industry.
Yeah.
And somewhere in there, he's interviewing some guy that's related to that story. And as an offhand side note, this guy mentions like the fentanyl thing.
Okay.
And Ben's like, what do you mean? Like you didn't know much about it. The guy starts explaining it and he's like, holy shit. He's writing this whole
thing
down.
What's going on? What?
And then as he's going through it, he starts looking at it more. He's like, this is a story. This needs to be written about. So he decides to write this book, Fentanyl Inc. And this savage, which is what he is. This takes incredible balls to do this.
Yeah.
He flew to China unaccompanied to go undercover, and that's being generous to call it undercover.
Track it down at
himself,
ground fucking zero.
Yes.
Yeah.
To go to one of these fentanyl labs and see how easy it was to buy fentanyl. And basically it was like walking into Walmart in whatever China's Walmart
wow.
is. And he was like, yeah, so I can take that. They're like, yeah, you want two or three? You know,
it's like what?
Oh my God. So I bring this up because it feels like when you look at the circle that's happening there within the fentanyl pouring literally across the border itself, being sent to Mexico, used by the cartels, but across our border,
boom,
coming in here. Does it feel like a reverse opium war to you?
Yes, very much so. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, except so many players that don't want to see us thrive, and China being one of them. It's just – it's maddening to see how easy this collaboration has kind of organically happened
yes.
with those two groups. and the damage that's been internally, I mean, outside of any military action or any violence taken against them or more aggressively against them that we would do, you know, domestically or even with or without, you know, with Mexico's help if they're dealing with that crisis down south, just that is a huge, you know, indicator of where we're at and who does not have our best interest or our people's best interest and just humanitarianism in general. I mean, we're poisoning our populace from within and basically deteriorating the country without ever firing a shot. And I don't think that's an exaggeration.
Outside of your ability to speak completely openly about things, being your own man now, working for the government and do things like talk in front of Congress and write books and make some shows, what have been like some of the major differences for you, good or bad or both, operating from the private side now versus having been on the active side in the fight with the government? Because you've been out for 5 years plus now.
Yeah, yeah. It's been mostly positive because, again, I can speak freely and I don't have to speak as somebody just from California. California, I speak as an American. Bottom line is everybody's affected. And it was really hard. And talking to the, you know, the guys that are either recently retired or about to retire out of the Met team, my crew of brothers, it's really hard when you're inside that agency and you're under that umbrella and the mindset of how we define things, what semantics we use, how soft and sugar-coated the problem really seems to be, how watered down it is. And we never talk about – we can't even call cannabis – we can't even call marijuana. We can't say weed. It's got to be cannabis. And you can't say it's an illegal weed farm. You could say it's an undocumented or it's an unregulated. So the whole thing was semantics to like, you know, we stopped this one particular operation and it had, you know, the cannabis was slightly under whatever, you know, and that mindset you get into what can I say? What can I do? What can I speak to? Well, it's a large world, man. Yeah. The country's really big. It's really diverse. Not everything is, you know, California politics.
No.
And one part about that is being a resident of Montana and going to a state that's more wired in what I'm about and where I grew up under the conservation model. It's nice living there, visiting California as a non-resident. I care immensely about California. It will always be home to some level. The amount of resources and diversity and people are amazing out in that state. And it's also the one that's most under siege, especially because of the problems we've discussed today. But it's all about the thin green line. I think when you start looking at the thin green line of protecting the three W's, wildlife, waterways, and wildlands, in any state, even the rural parts of New Jersey, New York, and you start making that a priority for our next generations, you inevitably are going to make public safety better. You're going to get more of a safety aspect of it. People are going to be healthier because they all go hand in hand. What I always had the separation from was I'm going and saving Bambi, right? Or protecting wildlife. But what about this drug situation? What about the, you know, the violent crimes against Americans, especially human child sex that now finally is getting the attention, Sound of Freedom, that movie. When that movie dropped, Julian, and I saw it with family members in the theater, I think it was like the 4th or 5th of July a couple of years ago. I've been working these guys, right? We all have, not necessarily on a child sex ring, but we've been working the same type of criminals doing similar stuff and we know it's going on. I almost tore the armrest off my freaking theater seat. I was crying my eyes out.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in the Patreon episode, by the way. That's coming up.
I felt so much pain for seeing the visceral aspect of what that movie personified perfectly and really realizing how helpless I felt as a law enforcement officer to know that I may not know a child that was directly trafficked or abducted that way, but I know people that do, or I've been related to people. Same thing with fentanyl deaths in, you know, the very affluent areas around Stanford. I know deaths of valedictorians headed to great schools that took a pain pill for a volleyball injury with a sore knee, went in to do her advanced placement, you know, calculus homework that night, a great, great young lady, and didn't wake up the next morning when mom woke her up, you know, so it's heartbreaking, man. It really is. And, so it's been positive being disconnected from agency, but having seen what I did all those years, really puts a good perspective on what you have to put your attention on. You know, it really does. You're not going to muddle in politics too much. You're not going to muddle through the weeds of insignificant issues. We've seen it directly in wildlife. We've seen it directly on human and health safety. And we know what we know, at least I know, and my teammates know, it is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, national priorities domestically, like we started this conversation with, that needs to be addressed and handled. And I hope we see that now.
Absolutely. If you, John Norris, were named president temporarily and had maybe even dangerously a little more power than the president, maybe you were emperor, John Norris. And you're a good emperor. You're like a good guy, right?
Scary
like,
thought, man.
Very scary thought, but I'm just using a hypothetical here. If you were named that for a temporary time just to fix this problem, and then at the end you could go back to your life, what would you do?
Right away, I'd border control. Mm-hmm. Change immigration policy immediately. You know, really make immigration a very positive thing. Encourage any person on this planet that wants to come to what we collectively know is the greatest country in the world because of the freedoms and opportunities we have, even in the worst situation. I would want to make that door open to great people. And I got a bias. You know, I bleed green, we say, on the thin green line. My blood's green. I love wildlife and waterways, and I want to see those protected sensibly. It doesn't mean you don't develop. It doesn't mean you don't, you know, timber harvest where you need to. It just means you don't decimate forests. You don't decimate waterways. You protect them through sensitive conservation models, not necessarily just preserve it and walk away because that has negative effects. That's what I would focus on. And this embedded cartel threat would be, I would make it a terrorism, an anti-terrorism campaign.
We gonna find you campaign.
Well, kind of one of those. Yeah. Call it eco-terrorism, call it terrorism, but
Dick Cheney just got hard.
I said, I liked what he said.
Yeah, that's not like, a compliment, but okay.
Oh, man. Hard as this dang table.
Like, how do we get Halliburton involved with this?
Yeah. Yeah, and do it sensibly, of course. You know, do it with the right resources and right awareness. And with that, finally would go educating of why we're doing it from our lowest, youngest level. Kids.
Important.
Yeah, we wouldn't, even in the affluent communities in the Silicon Valley where I come from, where we don't really, you know, expose our children to the dark side of the human condition.
Yes.
There's a real fucking dark side to us.
Yes.
And when money's involved and, you know, morality goes right out the door, the cartel threat we've seen personifies it. I've seen as evil as it gets, you know, as evil as it gets. And, you know, everything from, yeah. The patron saint shrines we've seen in the groves or in houses or in stash houses, these things that even looking at a deity that under someone's belief will sanction this kind of, you know, destructive behavior on people. And when you're believing that in your faith, that person's never going to be your friend and never going to do anything good within our borders. So they don't need to be here and they definitely don't need to be doing the activity they're doing.
100%. And I think, you know, I always say this, it's hard because I'm an emotional guy first. I always got to check that at the door.
I feel right?
I have
you.
The pragmatic brain, but the instant reaction is emotional. So I'm always like trying to turn it back on. Like the world, to quote Rocky Balboa, is not all sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's a mean and dark place and there's a lot of good in the world. And I believe there's more, way more good than evil, but you cannot deny that levels of evil exist and you cannot see – it is a dangerous slippery slope no matter what the context to see the world the way you want to see it versus the way it actually fucking is.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think has been a nice little theme across the history of my show with various people who have come in here is we've had people like you who in different ways, whether it be here or around the world – have seen it for what it can be in all the worst ways to be able to come back with a message that's hopefully positive, like, hey, we can fix this, but it does exist. So we got to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we can have a little effect on that using this show and then adding in all these other shows out there that are doing great similar things in that way, maybe we can move the needle and help with that education aspect you talk about.
Yeah, I agree. And I fondly say – I don't push a rifle with the guys on missions anymore, but the pen is mightier than the sword. It really is. And now I'm on a microphone instead of a carbine talking to you. And I totally agree, Julian, this is the way to do it. It's a way to inspire people. And I agree. I love the fact that I share that with you. The emotionality means we care because we get emotional on the same way. Big heart, but if you need to get serious to stop a problem, I have a very protective instinct, obviously, in what I did all those years. And I think first acknowledging it.
Yep.
And then saying, hey, but there's more good than evil. People as a whole, there's good out there. And that's what we got to focus on. But, not everybody's seeing it that way. Mm. And I don't think we're going to make a dent unless we're realists, a little more realism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Alessi, keep that thing rolling. We're going to do a Patreon episode right now, so don't stop it. But John, we'll obviously talk about some of the HT stuff in there and some other good stuff we haven't got to today. Thank you so much for coming here today, though. We're going to have your books, link in description. We're going to have your YouTube channel, link in description. It's really amazing work you've done, and I'm really glad you got to share it here.
Treat to be here, brother. Thanks for having me.
All right. Everybody else, you know what it is. Give it a thought. Get back to me, and I'll see you on Patreon.
Peace.
Thank you guys for watching the episode. Before you leave, please be sure to hit that subscribe button and smash that like button on the video. It's a huge help. And also, if you're over on Instagram, be sure to follow the show at Julian Dory Podcast, or also on my personal page at Julian D. Dory. Both links are in the description below. Finally, if you'd like to catch up on our latest episodes, use the Julian Dory Podcast playlist link in the description below. Thank you.